So a couple prefaces things. So today we're going to do the 8201. But I wanted to just loop back. A couple of you guys have reached out as far as write-ups for your grade, and I've responded to some of you. I think there's a couple I still have to get back to on ideas. For those who I have responded, I think what happens all the time, so this is not anything with you guys, is the subject matter is always huge. And then if you start writing on it, you're like, oh my God, I can't write on it. So I will help you narrow it. And so I've done that, I think, with one or two of you guys. Anybody can write up. Obviously, if you've got an A, you don't need to write up. But if you want to get an A and you have a B, you're totally fine to write up to. So, and there is no deadline. Somebody asked me, like, when do I have to have the paper done and everything else? There's no deadline for me. Once I get the paper and I'm going to read it that day or the next day, and I'll get it done and get you guys the response. However, I have seen over the last 10 or 12 years that those who want to, that reach out to me after the midterm and want to write an exam, next thing you know, it's the end of April, and or write a paper, and it's the end of April, and you're like, oh my God, I got to do this, 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 and then you're kind of jammed. So my recommendation is if you are interested, whether it's to get whatever your grade bump that you want to get, do it sooner than later. And really, I know time is precious no matter what to everybody, but it really doesn't take that much time. So that's my only tip. All right. With that, we are going to talk about the A201 today. Now, the A201 is the other kind of main document that you guys are going to use forever in the practice of architecture. It's been around for over 120 years. It's updated every 10 years. The version we're looking at is the 2017. They'll do another one in 2027. It is the prime rules to monopoly, as I always use the example, for the owner-contractor side. So you guys, we did first was the B101, that's the owner-architect. The A201 is the owner-contractor. A couple of other little pieces so you'd understand. So with the architect side of the agreement, so the AIA suite of documents is what I call them, the B101 is all-encompassing. So it has, for the owner-architect, it has the scope of the services. So I'm going to do, you know, schematic, design, development, construction documents, everything that they're supposed to do. It has their duties and obligations, and it has the price, and it has the time, and the description. So it's a single document that's all-encompassing. On the A series, B is all architect side. The A series is all contractor side. And on the contractor side, this document, the A201, actually pairs with a document or different documents of an A100 series. And we have a lecture a little later that talks a little bit more about this. But there's the 101, the 102, the 103, the 104. There's all different versions of that. And the way it's broken out for the A series is the 100 A100, 101, 102, 103. Those are the price and the schedule and the description of the project. So it's the business terms is the A100 series. The A200 series, and there's more than just the 201, but the 201 is by far the most used with the 100 when you match them up. On the 200 series, that's what's called the general conditions. And I call it the rules to the road or the rules monopoly because it's here's what the contractor is obligated to do in constructing the project, how they actually build it, and what their obligations are with respect to the work with a capital W. So the 100 series, you would always think about in your head as business terms, and the 200 series is the terms of how to perform the work. Okay? What you also will see in your course of your career is you will see many, many documents that don't say AIA, form, document, everything else. And when you start reading the terms and conditions, you're going to be like, oh, well, this is just taken from the AIA. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The most important reason is because it's a really good document. It's been around, like I said, for over 100 years. Since they update it every 10 years, they try to take into consideration trends and issues in construction industry. They try to make sure that it's current and up-to-date and encompasses everybody. The other reason why it's so good of a document is when they draft this, they have a committee. And the committee is made up of contractors, owners, architects, lawyers, governmental employees. So they bring in groups from all different walks of life, all different parts of the construction industry, and they all have input. So while it's an AIA document, American Institute of Architects, and it still has an architect-owner slant, kind of like the B101 does, it is, in my opinion, the most balanced, the most even documents of the form. So this is like a form suite of documents. There are other very important form documents. There's one thing called the consensus docs, and those are put together by the contractors. There's another thing by the AGCDC, or the EJCDC, that's the E for engineers, so the engineers have their suite of documents. There's the Design Build Institute of America, they have their suite. So every one of these kind of larger groups, architects, engineers, contractors, design builders, they all have their own suite of forms to use. But the AIAs, in my opinion, and I think largely across the board, are by far the most balanced, and as a result, they're the most used. So you're going to see these terms over and over and over. Now, you may be asking, okay, well, why do I care? I'm an architect. Yeah, I understand why Hanahan taught me about the B101, because I need to do that. Why do I care about the A201? Well, we'll see as we get into the document. There's actually Article 4 is all about you. And you have obligations as the architect on a project. And so you need to understand how this contract works. As the project is going along and as the contractor is building what you designed, you need to make sure that she or he are following the rules. And remember, the AIA works as a suite of documents. So the rules that you're following in the A, B, or the B101 are actually mirrored in the A201. And so you need to understand how the documents work together. You need to understand how to advise your client on whether the contractor is complying with the terms of this document. So it's just a good understanding. And then the last, and probably closer to your guys' heart, near and dear to your heart, the last reason why you need to know this document is because when you do sit for the exam, they will test you on this. They're going to test you on the B101 and the A201. And the terms of these two documents and what I lecture on will be what you're going to be looking for in answering questions. So that's, you know, when you guys ultimately want to sit down and get your exam and get your license, this is what you're going to look for. So, any questions kind of on the overview? All right, good. All right, so let's get into the document. All right, I'm going to move you guys. Let me make that disappear. Move this over here. Okay, so I'm sure you guys didn't read through all the slides. It's a huge slide deck. So I'm going to have to move even faster than I moved when I did the B101. But we will get through it in the 2 hours and 50 minutes today. And then we're going to go and dive into next week. And we're only going to get through Article 5. Now, there's 14 or 15 articles on it, and you're like, oh, my God, how do we get through if we only get through Article 5? The front five articles are the guts. And so we'll get through those today, and then we'll finish those up, the remaining 6 through 15, after your break. So without further ado, we will go in. So starting out, general provisions. And what you're going to see also is you're going to see language that's very similar to what you've seen in the B101. So the first one is this defines what the contract document. So if you remember, I talked about contract, any term in a contract that are capitalized, and you'll see in this paragraph there's lots of things that are capitalized. Those are defined terms, also called terms of art. And we want to define what the contract documents are. The contract documents are all those things in 1 through 4. And what's important here, though, is they don't include. What I highlighted here is if you think about it, when you're designing and you're putting together a project, you know, you got your drawings, your specs, you got all these other things, the actual contract, change orders and stuff. But what you want to remember is what's not included in the contract documents. And that's what we have highlighted here. It doesn't include advertisements of the invitation for bid, sometimes called the RFP, the instructions, sample forms, and other stuff prior to signing the contract. The reason why that's important is because things change. Like if I issue an RFP for a new project, and I'm building my toy factory, and I send it out to bids, and I get five bids from five different contractors, well, during the course of the negotiation of awarding to one of those five bidders, I may change some of the terms and conditions. So, of course, my instructions to bidders or my original contract can't be a contract document because it's not going to be used later on. It's pulled out. So you want to remember what's not part of the contract documents. And the final thing on this slide is, as what the contract documents are, is when we talk about the contract, with a capital C, with the contractor, it's not just the A201, which is the agreement with capital A. It's all of these things listed. So that means that the contractor, under its contract, is obligated to follow everything in these various elements. So they have to follow what's in the drawings, the specs, the change order. They have to follow all of those. It's not just the one document, which is the agreement. Okay? Is that a question? Sorry. Let's move on. Why didn't it turn? Okay. So here's the contract. And it says the contract documents form the contract for construction, which is what I said, and it supersedes prior negotiation. So anything that we're talking about prior to signing on the dotted line goes away. So, and this we talked a little bit about in the formation of contracts in our earlier lectures, and we were a little bit tested. You know, if you have this, and that was that one exam question where you had the oral discussion on the phone, and then there was the following letter that was written confirming what the oral discussion was. Technically, that created a written contract, although I gave everybody credit because it also technically created an oral contract. But what this thing says is this document, when you sign it, supersedes everything else. And the other thing that we have in the slide is it shows that the contract is only between the contractor and the owner. It doesn't create any relationship between contractor and architect, the owner and the sub, the owner and the architect, or any of those things. So while I did say you can have a contract with multiple parties as members or participants of that, you know, of that contract, this one says, the term in here for the definition contract is this is only between the owner and the contractor. The other way you want to think about it, and when I teach in person, I'll have a whiteboard and I'll draw this, but imagine a triangle. And I think I may have said this before, but probably not as many times as I normally would do. So imagine a triangle. And at the top of the triangle is the owner. And at the bottom two corners is the architect and the contractor. And you're going to see a solid line between owner and architect. And you're going to imagine a solid line between owner and contractor. That solid line represents the contract, that they have this agreement between each other. At the bottom of the triangle, there's going to be a dotted line. The dotted line connects the architect and the contractor. Because it's not solid, that's to say, we don't have any contractual relations. We don't have any obligations to each other, but we owe things to each other through the solid lines. So we're going to be communicating, we're going to be following the rules through our respective solid lines. So the architect follows the rules of its game on this side, and the contractor follows the rules of its game on that side. And that's what 1.1.2 says as well. Okay? The work. The work, with a capital W, is all the stuff that's used to build the project. And the project is the total construction of the work, but it could include more. So let's go back to the example that I used about the hotel. So you're going to hire a contractor to build a hotel, but you want that really cool star restaurant, and you want that really cool kitchen with the open fireplace, and so people can come in, and it's part of your project. Well, you may not only hire the cool restaurant designer, but you may hire a specialty contractor to build out that kitchen. So most of the examples I've done to date have been, because it's on the design side, is your architect designs the whole building, but you leave a little space for the specialty kitchen designer. Well, this one, you're going to do the specialty construction too. So the contractor, its work is building the hotel. The project is the hotel plus the kitchen. Now, the contractor is not responsible for the design nor the construction of the kitchen. That's by the owner's separate contractor. But that's the overall project. And the project could also include landscape and the pool and maybe, you know, who knows what else is going on. So think about it as work is under the contractor's umbrella and the project is over everything. Okay? The drawings, both are the same as what we had in the drawings that the architect's going to be prepared. Specifications, same thing. In 1.1.6, the specifications are what the architect prepares to make sure that the contractor can use those to perform the work. And then 1.1.7, the instruments of service. And you probably are seeing, oh my God, these are the same terms I saw in the B101. The instruments of service, some strange, weird word. But if you remember from the B101, it includes drawing specifications, other type of models, other perspective drawings, anything else. So it's the expression by which the architect has created the project, the design. So it's this overall instrument of service. Now it's relevant here because the contractor needs to know who owns the rights in it and how they get the rights to do that. And that's spelled out in Article 7 of the B101. But as I said, since these documents are interchangeable, they touch base on some of that here. Okay? 1.1.8, the initial decision maker. Again, a term that was in the B101. And this is where the architect may be the person first in before you go to mediation, before you go to arbitration or court. The architect's going to be the initial decision maker. And they're the ones that's going to have to first figure out or make some type of decision in good faith as to what should be the result of a dispute that may be between owner and contractor. Now, if you remember in the B101, it by default states that the architect is the initial decision maker, but it includes language that allows the owner to choose a different initial decision maker. Sometimes you hire a third party and remove the architect from the equation altogether. As you can see here, 1.1.8 doesn't reference either the architect or a third party because that should be already established through the B101, and the contractor doesn't necessarily care who it is. They just need to know that there's an initial decision maker, some entity out there that's going to be helping to make decisions on disputes between the parties. One little tiny side you don't need to worry about for the exam, but what I often do, depending on my owner, is I often will remove the initial decision maker concept altogether. Some owners, depending on the projects, find it's another layer that's cumbersome that they feel that they can do business-wise, they can do themselves between senior business people and senior business people, and then after that it goes to the mediation process. But again, that's something you'll have to have discussions with your client about what you want to do with that. Okay. 1.2, the correlation and intent of the contract documents. If you remember in the B101, there's language that talks about you are going to make sure that your job as the architect, when you observe the construction ongoing, is to make sure that the work is being performed in accordance with the intent of the contract documents. And that's what's talked about here, is that it's to include all items necessary for the proper execution and completion of the work by the contractor. So it's to say, you should have the intent of the contract. You should have everything you need to build. But it may not have 100%, because as I said many, many times, your drawings are not 100% complete. They're just never going to be perfect. They're never going to have that much information. So a lot of it is up to the contractor on what's called constructability and everything else. And so that's what it says. The contract documents are complementary, and performance by the contractor should be required only to the extent consistent with the contract documents and reasonably inferable from them being necessary to produce the indicated results. So here's where, as far as all that we've talked about thus far, here's the first place where you will potentially see why contracts sometimes go awry, why there's disputes, but certainly why change orders are going to be necessary. We'll get into change orders later, more next week, but we'll talk about them as we kind of work the way through today. Because, as I said, since the contract documents will never be 100%, and it's known in the industry that contractors should know how to build something. They should know how to, you know, you don't have to give them a nail hole pattern or a bolt hole pattern or some of those things. They should be able to reasonably infer from the contract documents of how they're supposed to build it. Sometimes, however, the contractor is going to say, I don't know what you mean here. Your drawings aren't sufficient, so they send out an RFI, request for information, and maybe the architect gives a little more detail. And in the detail, when it comes back, the contractor's like, whoa, wait a minute, this is not what I did. This is not at all what I thought you were going to do. That requires a change order. It's going to cost more money and more time to build it the way you really think it should be. And then the architect says, no, you should have inferred that, and that's where your dispute comes, because who has to pay for that increased construction? That would be the contractor, or the owner. So let me give you an example of that so you can kind of understand how it is, how it can work, what happens in the field. So one of my clients for a number of years has been Navy Pier. So Navy Pier in 2012 started a horizontal renovation of the entire pier, and they changed many things exterior-wise. They brought in this James Cornerfield operations, this large kind of urban designer. And one of the things they ended up having to do was they put a number of trees on the pier. Now, if you guys know, or maybe don't, the pier sits on a number of literally piers in the water, and it's not on ground. And that pier is not on ground. It's sitting on a bunch of pilings that's pounded into the bottom of Lake Michigan. So how do you plant a tree? Well, they had these huge, giant pots. They were massive. I think they were like, I don't know, like 8 or 10 feet wide, and they would set them down into to the pier itself, and they had to figure out how those connections were going to be done. So the architect designed these and had relatively detailed drawings, but not fully detailed out, because it's very unique. And the contractor did the project. And then when they came to start doing the installation of those things, they sent some RFIs and said, well, how do you do this? Well, it turned out that the architect arguably didn't think it through. And so there was significant additional details in the response to the RFI, the request for information, on how to build these giant tree pots. And as a result, the contractor came back with a change order, and the change order was in the millions. I mean, it was not a cheap event, because there were many, many trees, and these are huge things. And the argument came down to this part right here. What was reasonably inferable from the first set of drawings, and if it wasn't reasonably inferable, then the contractor should get a change order to pay for the initial work. If it is reasonably inferable, you look to the contractor and say, everybody should have known how to do that. You don't get a change order for the work. So this is an important provision as how you interpret the contract, and where you may be brought in as the architect, because the owner's going to look to you and say, well, should they have known, or should they have known from the drawings you prepared? So, any questions on that? All right, great. Okay. So 1.2.11, this is just talking about if one provision of this contract is considered invaluable or invalid or unenforceable, it doesn't get rid of the whole contract. And if you remember, we were talking about contracts can be void, they're voidable, they're unenforceable. There's, you know, some of those provisions we talked about earlier in, I think, the second lecture. What this provision tries to do in 1.2.11 is to say, if one provision isn't legal or right or void, it doesn't. You don't throw the whole baby out. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater or whatever that slogan is. You just excise the one provision, and the rest of the contract still is okay. So that's what that's saying here. It's how to not find yourself stuck without a contract because you got one thing wrong. Okay. Talks about capitalization interpretation. Those are things that we've talked about before. 1.5, the ownership and use of drawings, specifications, and other instances of services. So again, we're harkening back to the language you guys learned under Article 7 in the B101. The architect and their consultant shall be deemed authors and owners of their respective instruments of services, including the drawing specifications, and retaining all common law, statutory, and other reserve rights in their instruments of service, including copyrights. Now, while this isn't word for word what you guys saw in the B101, it's effectively the same thing. It's basically telling the contractor, hey, architect owns these drawings, and they have the copyrights in it, and you're not allowed to take those drawings onto your next project and steal them or whatever you want to do because you don't own them. There's a license, as you recall, being granted to the owner, and the owner can transfer that license to the contractor. But this is just to say, hey, contractor, you got to watch out because these aren't yours. You're just using them for this project. 1.5.2, this is where you're authorized to use and reproduce the instruments of service subject to protocols established in 1.7.1.8 solely and exclusively for the execution of the work. So it's just for this project. So what you want to make sure that happens, let's say we're in a situation where there's two phases to a project. Phase one, you have these drawings, you have this contract, and you're supposed to use it for the work. The work is phase one. The project would be phase one and two. So you can only use these drawings, even if it's a duplicate near building, for this work, if you're the contractor. Now, if the owner comes back to you and says, hey, I want to build phase two, just use the same drawings. If you're the contractor, the first thing you want to ask is, am I allowed to use those same drawings for phase two? Do you have a license? Are you authorizing me to use these for phase two? Because if not, not only would the owner be violating the license that it had with the architect, but so would the contractor. And then, therefore, the contractor and the owner both would be subject to lawsuits by the architect for stealing their drawings. So that's what this is trying to say. It's making sure you're using it for this work and this work only. And that's all your license is for. And then 1.6, this is something that is a little different in the 2017 versus earlier, the 2007s and earlier versions. So this is where the term notice, where notice, and see how notice in this paragraph in 1.6.1 is not capitalized. That's because this paragraph says, if you ever see the word notice in this document, you must give that notice in writing. In previous versions, notice with a capital N would require writing, and notice without a capital would not require writing, but sometimes people would require it, so it kind of was, it was inconsistent. So the AIA came back and said, let's make clarity. Let's not have capital N or lowercase n or anything else. Let's just say, anytime we use the word notice between one party and the other, for whatever reason that notice is, it has to be in writing, it has to follow the rules of 1.6.1. Except, let me go back here. Oh, why did I go backwards? Sorry, I went the wrong way. There. It's prefaced with except as otherwise provided in 1.6.2. Okay? So we get to 1.6.2. And 1.6.2 is notice that here must be by certified or registered mail. So not only is it in writing, but it has to be by certified or registered mail. So there's only specific times when this notice has to come in this matter. Every other type of notice, you can do it by email, you can do it by regular letter, you can do it on the back of a napkin as long as it's in writing in some form or the other. Okay? And this is important. Again, you may be in charge by your owner. The owner may, you as the architect, may be asking you to be interpreting this agreement or administering it somehow, not actually being like an owner's rep, but you have the responsibility that you may be the party to whom notice is sent. That may be just something that's in your role as the architect on the project. And if there's a specific time that it needs to be by certified or registered mail, and you don't get it that way, then you would inform the owner their notice is deficient. That's relevant in lawsuits and otherwise, whether they have properly given you notice. Okay. 1.7, digital data use and transmission. This is, if you remember this E203, this was talked about in the B101. This is just that rules, these are another series of rules that we may use another document, this E203, that talks about how digital documentation is transmitted between one party and the other and the protocols for that. Sometimes people use the E203. Sometimes they have their own sets of digital data transmission. I actually have my own set that I use. It's a little less complicated than E203, but what you want to make sure is that all the parties understand how the drawings and specification and contract documents are communicated, because everything's electronic these days. And then 1.8, building information modeling, use, and reliance. So BIM, again, this is talking about the E203. BIM is a specific way that people build projects nowadays. And so this just talks about if you're going to be using BIM, you want to follow the rules that are at 1.8. Okay? As you get out, you start practicing, you'll hear some of these terms a lot more. It's not as relevant. I'm not going to be testing you guys on BIM or the digital data protocols, but these will become more relevant when you have project websites and when you're out there working, as to how you're communicating between everybody. And that is the end of the general background, kind of the setup for the article, for the contract. Any questions on Article 1? Good. Okay. As with the B101, now we're going to go through the various articles of your obligations, the three main parties. The owners, Article 2, the contractors, Article 3, and the architect is Article 4. And then Article 5, which we'll get through, and that's our last article, is subcontractors. So we'll work through 2, 3, 4, and 5. And we're going to talk about what you have to do if you're each one of these parties. And as a result, the contractor sees these the obligations of the owners, so I can rely on those. And the owner says these are the obligations of the contractor, I can rely on them. So, first, 2.1.1, you're going to designate the owner as someone who is approved and has authorization to act on your behalf. That's the agency thing. You're going to identify who that individual or series of individuals are that can bind the owner, create your agency. And then it says, except as otherwise provided in Section 421, the architect does not have such authority. And when we get to 421, what you're going to see is you're going to see the exact same language that you saw in the B101. Remember, in the B101 it said, except for where it says specifically as follows, the architect is not acting as the owner's agent. And that's what this is doing here. Again, this consistency between the AIA suite of documents. The reason why it's for here is you want to let the contractor know, hey, if the architect tells me something on the site and they don't have the authority to tell me that, I cannot rely on that, nor can I charge the owner if I incur costs for that. The only time that the architect talks to me and they're speaking on behalf of the owner is what we'll see that's in Article 421. We'll get there eventually. Okay. Article 2.2, evidence of owner's financial arrangements. Well, here is the contractor, and this is where you can see the contractor had involvement in drafting this agreement. In 2.2.1 it says, prior to the commencement of the work, so before I put any shovel into ground, if I request, if I request, the owner needs to give me reasonable evidence that you're going to be able to pay for this project, that you have made financial arrangements to fill your obligations under the contract. So I want to see your balance sheet. I want to see to make sure I'm not going to enter into a contract with you unless you show me what you're worth. This is actually exercised, you'd be surprised, quite often. The interesting thing is, how often does the owner comply with this? So I have a client right now, I think I've mentioned this a few times, they're building a project up in Wisconsin. I can't remember if I told you, but the client is Haribo. They make gummy bears. So it's kind of the most fun client I've ever had, because every time I go to their office, they give me bags of gummy bears. Hold on a second. Give me one second. And I come home from my meetings, and my kids love me because I get bags and bags and bags of gummies. So they're like the greatest client in the world for my kids. My wife hates it because it's going to rot my kids' teeth, but that's okay. In any event, Haribo, a German company, is privately owned, family owned. And so they're building this factory up in Wisconsin. It's going to be their largest factory. Hold on a second here. Chat. Yes, it's great. And I hesitate to say this. Oh, it went to the wrong slide. Because if we were teaching in person, I would bring in gummies, but like I can't hand out gummies for COVID and everything else. So I feel bad because they used to bring in candy to my students. In any event, so when we were entering into this agreement with this contract, it's going to be the largest factory that Haribo has ever built in the world. And it's a huge project. And so the contractor, which is a really, really good contractor, they exercised this provision. They said, we want to see, before we enter into the agreement with you, we want to make sure you guys have the money. And Haribo said no. He said, nope, we're not going to give you our books. You guys just got to trust us. Now, if you go online, this is the one thing I didn't realize when I first was working with them. You just go to Wikipedia and you read about it. They sell 100 million pieces of this candy, so each individual one, 100 million gummies a day, every day. It's a $7 billion, makes $7 billion a year in revenue. So they have plenty of money to build a factory. But the contractor had to exercise, they tried to exercise it. So sometimes the owner says, no, I'm not giving you my financials. If you don't want to do the work, you don't have to do the work, there's somebody else that will do it. But most of the time, they'll exercise this. Sometimes the owner will give some type of limited financial statements. But it's to give the contractor some security. And so this is, I just wanted to call it out because it's important for the contractor to know I'm not entering into this kind of on a whim and a prayer here. So,
do owners not release financial information just for like privacy reasons, or?
Yep, and you're going to find this. You're going to find it more with privately owned companies. You know, they don't want everybody to know what's going on with their internal business, because if it's privately owned, if it's family owned, then releasing financial statements is not just simply what the company is. If it's a publicly traded company, well, they're going to have their audited financial statements that they release, and they're going to release that in some fashion or the other. And maybe the contractor, if the contractor doesn't own stock in that publicly traded company, they wouldn't have those financials, so that's something that's easily and readily available. But you'll find more privately owned entities that'll say, I don't want to give it up. You just got to trust me that I'm a big giant company, or I'll be able to pay your bills and go from there. And on the flip side, you'd be surprised how many times the contractors are like, they'll do what they need in their own due diligence, and they're like, okay, we're fine. And that's what happened here. Great contractor, the relationship has gone fabulously so far, and they just said, fine, we don't need to see your financials. So that was good. Okay. Then 222 says, hey, once we start work, if there's something going wrong here, something else, then because it's under these three obligations, if the owner fails to make payments, so if you're late on payment, or if there's some concern about the owner making payments, like, oh, I read in the news today that you guys had a huge financial hit, I want to make sure that you can pay me, or if there's a change in the work of material, changes the contract sum. So we're building this $10 million toy factory, and all of a sudden it goes from $10 million to $20 million, well, now the project is doubled. So maybe I'm concerned. I didn't ask you in the beginning for your financials before I started work, but now I'm not sure. So if one of these things come up, the contractor then can again ask for the financials. And then if, so it talks about later, it says, if a request is made because of the change in the work materially changes the contract under number three above, the contractor may immediately stop that portion of the work affected by the change until reasonable evidence is provided. Now, that's pretty drastic, but it protects the contractor. They're basically saying, if you're doubling this project, if you're adding on, your $1 million house becomes a $2 million house, I'm not going to work on anything of the addition until you prove to me you can pay it. And the contractor's protected. They're not in breach because they stop work. They don't have any risk here. They're just saying, you have to give me assurance, whatever that reasonable assurance is, that you can pay me. So it's pretty drastic and pretty protective of the contractor. I can say in my 30 years of doing this, I've never had anyone exercise this second half of 2-2. I've had some people ask questions in the first half. Can I get some updated financials? And it's done and we're fine. But I've never had any contractor to say, I'm not going to continue working on the new stuff until you give me. So I don't know how this would be litigated out, But I will tell you that this provision is in here because there must have been enough litigation over instances like this, but contractors raised their hands on the next round between 97 and 2007 or 87 and 97, whatever the version of the H01, and said, we got to protect ourselves. And so this was added. So it's an interesting provision. I just have never seen it exercised. So, okay, 223. After you give financial arrangements under this section 2.2, the owner may not materially vary such financial arrangements without prior notice to the contractor. So let's say we're building a condo high-rise. It's got 200 units. And you show the contractor that you have, this is my construction loan, and this is going to be my mezz loan, and this is how we're going to convert it over into a regular mortgage once you guys finish the project out, and we're all good. Everything's fine, you start building. And then the owner goes back and says they renegotiated a better deal with the new bank. That's a material variation from the original loan information you gave the contractor. And you must, this says, must give this information. Shall not materially vary the financial arrangements without prior notice to the contractor. And here, this says to the owner, I don't even have to wait for a request by the contractor. I must give this information because it shall not materially vary without prior notice. So I must, in writing, tell the contractor I'm changing banks or whatever that financial situation was on how they were going to pay for the project. So a little different than 2.1 and 2.2 where the contractor's asking. 2.2.3 says you must give it regardless. Okay? 224 just talks about confidential information. If something's been designated as confidential, the contractor must keep it confidential. And it has a little more information about how confidential information is treated, who else they can disclose it to, because if it's only the contractor, well, maybe it relates to how the project is being built. So your sub should be able to see it, and maybe the surety and the insurance people, maybe their lawyers. So there's some leeway of who the contractor can disclose it to, but it's important that the contractor knows confidential information must remain confidential. So let's go back to an example of financials. Maybe the owner says, okay, you, contractor, want to know my balance sheet. I'll give you that information, but I'm not a publicly traded company. I'm a privately closed company. I'm not solely owned, but I'm privately closed. So we're going to keep this information, this financial information, confidential. You can be satisfied I have the money to pay for the project, but you can't be telling everybody else how I run my business and what my finances are. So that would be one way. Other things may have to do with intellectual property secrets relating to the work. So let me give you another example of Haribo. Haribo is extremely, extremely confidential about the equipment they use to make their gummy bears. Of course, I'm biased, but I think their gummy bears are the best in taste and texture than all the other gummies that are out there. And so, and they pride themselves on their intellectual property of how they create their formula and how they actually create the candies and the processes by which they go through. So right now we're in the phase of just building the core and shell of the factory. But at some point in the future, we're going to have to bring in their equipment. And Haribo is so protective of that equipment, they are going to have their own internal teams assembling those pieces, the machinery that's going to build the candy, or create the candy. The contractor is still going to be on site working and building things. And Haribo is going to designate anything that relates to this equipment as confidential. So they can't let anybody know about their protective secrets. In fact, we're actually in the process of talking about how we're going to put like a huge, like, because it's this giant building, obviously. We're going to build this huge kind of like tarp or enclosure that'll go around, so there will be very few people that will actually see what the equipment, how it's assembled and put together. It's kind of pretty cool, but it's all about confidentiality, and that's where 224 comes in. So, all right, moving on. Information and services required of the owner. So the owner has to provide certain information relating to the project, and this is what the contractor is going to expect the owner to do. So in 231, I got to pay for approvals if there's easements. You know, this is relating to the actual, what's there on the project site, the land. If you want to think about it, the land is on the owner's side. What do they have to do with the land and where they can build? That sometimes comes with permits and approvals. One of the things, this is being built, the Haribo facility is being built in Pleasant Prairie. So you got to get all these city approvals and permits. And they had to have an easement to allow themselves to access the site, some other stuff. So that's all in the owner. And the contractor doesn't do it. The owner doesn't just come to the contractor and say, here's some drawings, I own the land, you figure it out. No, the owner has their own obligations of this information. 232, you got to hire a licensed architect. Pretty simple, pretty basic. The contractor doesn't want to build something that's not been designed by a licensed architect. 234, we have to have surveys of what the land, what's the topography, what's the geotech, what's going on, so that the contractor can understand what's going to be built. And it says here in the second half of 234, the contractor shall be entitled to rely on the accuracy of the information furnished by the owner. That's important. If you give me a survey, if you give me soil samples, I can rely on that. I don't have to go out and check your math. If you remember, in the B101, shop drawings are done by the subcontractors, and the architect doesn't have to check the math of the subcontractor. This is kind of the flip side. Owner's going to provide surveys and other information. Contractor doesn't have to check the math of what the owner gives. So that's a contractor added provision into this, or part of a provision added into this section. And then it flips back. It says, but shall exercise proper precautions relating to the safe performance of the work. So while you can rely on the accuracy of what I'm giving you, if you go out there and you find out, maybe the soil isn't exactly what it is, what it says in the soil sample, you still have to be responsible as a contractor. You have to exercise your own proper precautions. So it's give a little, take a little, is the way these documents, and that's why they're so fair. I can go through this whole document, and I can tell you, just like this one provision, I can tell you that the contractor had hands in drafting the first half of the sentence, and the owner had hands in the second half. And that goes throughout the entire agreement. So I just wanted to point that out. Who's got responsibility for what? Even though we're talking about owner's responsibility, it's still going back to the contractor here. And then 235, you have to give information within reasonable promptness, keep the project moving along. So not only does the contractor have to follow schedule, owner does too. 2.4, owner's right to stop work. Now this is a big deal. I've had this exercise a few times in my projects, and it's when if the contractor's not doing, repeatedly fails to carry out the work. Owner can have a written order to tell them to stop until you fix it. Or stop the work and the owner, which will be stated in 2.3.2.5, the owner can carry out the work. So what happens here, and I had this on a big project actually with Navy Pier, we got to the point where the contractor was performing so poorly, the first contractor, as far as meeting schedule and otherwise, the Navy Pier came in and issued a stop notice order. And they told them, you have to stop doing work under 2.4. And then we exercise our rights under 2.5. If the contractor defaults or neglects to carry out the work in accordance with the contract documents, so if there's a default, and fails in 10-day periods, so you give them a 10-day notice to fix things or start correcting it, the owner can come in and bring their own people in to correct the work. And then they use whatever those costs were. So let's say, for example, you needed to finish some electrical work, and the owner had to incur $100,000 to finish the electrical work. But maybe you only owed on the contract $40,000 for the contractor to finish, but it cost you $100,000. Well, you can remember from our expectation damages analysis, you spent $100, you expected to pay $40, so the damages would be $60,000. And for that, our owner, under this provision, can use current or future payments to cover the amounts. And the contractor shall pay the difference to the owner. So this is where a dispute could happen. Hey, you're not doing your job, you've defaulted, I'm giving you a 10-day notice. you still haven't fixed it. I'm going to bring in my own electrician, and I'm going to take current and future payments that I was going to pay you, and I'm going to use those to pay the other contractor. And if you have a beef with me, contractor, you can file a claim under Article 15. So that's what this thing does. It is an Article 2.4, going back one slide. This right to stop the work is kind of like a nuclear option. It's not so far as termination, that is the full nuclear option. But stopping the work and bringing your own parties in is a big deal, because now the owner has other obligations and responsibilities. They have to run the project, and it's very, very costly. So it's not often exercised, but I've had a number of projects that have had it happen. And then, as you can imagine, because not only are you doing the work, but you're taking payments away from the contractor, it can cause litigation or other disputes. So it brings lots of bad blood on the project. Any questions on 2.4 and 2.5? Okay? All right, so that's it. That's it. That's all the owner has to do, right? They just have to, like, we got to give you some surveys. We got to give you some information. I got to hire an architect. Here's my owner's rep. And I can stop the work whenever I want if you defaulted. That's it. That's all the obligations of the owner. But that's okay, because the owner's writing the check. And the owner's not building. So that makes sense. So let's talk about Article 3, the contractor. What are their responsibilities? Check the time. Okay. So in general, contractor is, if you have to identify, contractor means the contractor or the contractor's authorized representative. So you got to be licensed, you got to be this contractor, so it's pretty simple. They're going to perform under 3.1.2, perform the work, not build the project, but perform the work in accordance with the contract documents. Now, I point this out here because, of course, that's what we're going to do. You're going to do the work, and you got to use the contract documents. It's pretty basic. The one thing about a really good contract, and this is why the AAA is a good contract, is even the more simple, basic duties and obligations are just kind of spelled out there, simple and basic. I'm the contractor. I'm going to do the work in accordance with the contract documents. It's that simple. So let's put it down. Let's not assume that. Let's just write it down. So that's good contractor acting as well. It's also why when you print this thing out, I just got internet connection unstable. Can you guys still hear me? Okay, good.
You went out for like a second.
Okay, good. So, oh my God, you guys missed the, yeah, the earlier this week, this is completely aside, but that's why I was a little nervous when I saw that come up. Our cable went out, our internet went out like Sunday afternoon. Sunday morning, I'm not sure which. And, of course, that was the day that I was... We have a fence in our backyard, but we don't have any gates. So on either side of the house is this big open place where the dog can run around. So I went out and bought chicken wire and some steaks. And that's, of course, when the internet went out, was when I was staking these little mini fences until we can get a real gate built. And so I was in the doghouse because it appears it was thought that my staking cut the cable line from Comcast. So I called Comcast on Sunday, and you know, because Comcast is totally on the ball, they didn't get here till Tuesday evening. So we went all Monday and all Tuesday with my son on his having to do remote learning, and my wife with her business, and me using our phones as like Wi-Fi hotspots, which was not very good. And then Comcast finally came out. Thank God, it turned out that the next door neighbor's dog or some other critter chewed the wire in the back of the house, and it wasn't my fault. But that's why I was nervous, because we just got new cable up on Wednesday, and I was like, oh my God, if it goes out again, I'm going to... It was very stressful, because you can't run your business without internet these days. So, okay, I digress. 3.1.3. Contractor should not be relieved of its obligations to perform the work in accordance with the contract documents, either by the activities or duties of the architect and the architect's administration of the contract. Basically, what this says is, if you remember back earlier in the Article 1, hey, the architect can't tell me to stop the work. The architect can't tell me that I don't have any duties or obligations. The architect is not part of this contract. It's the solid line of the triangle, the architect is not in that solid line. There's just the dots on the bottom. And so, doesn't matter what the architect says. Contractor will not be relieved of its duties under to perform the work under this contract. Again, it's basic and simple, but you need to have that in there because there's been plenty of litigation where the contractor says, well, the architect told me I didn't have to do this, or the architect told me I shouldn't do this. And the owner says, great, so the architect did that. What did 3.1.3 said? It says you still have to follow this contract and you still have to do your work. Forget about the architect, except for, and we'll get in Article 4 what those spots are, but this is what's important here. So that's why it's in there. 3.2, review of contract documents and field conditions by contractor. So this is an important one. 3.2.1, execution of the contract for the contractor, so by signing this agreement, is a representation that the contractor has visited the site and become generally familiar with the local conditions. So not just what the site looks like, but everything else, like how do they work with the relationship with the city or all these other things. And had correlated personal observations with the requirements of the contract documents. Meaning, I went out, I saw what I was supposed to build, I saw what the land looked like, I know what the obligations are under the city and the codes, I know what OSHA says, and now with all this information, I'm signing this contract for like $10 million, and I can do this work. So this is a representation that I'm not just with blinders. Here's some drawings, here's some specs, and here's a contract. That's what I'm doing. No, this is I've kind of come to the whole understanding of what the whole project's going to be so I can perform the work. That's very important later on as you get into constructability and the obligations. 3.2.2 says, because the contract documents are complementary, meaning they complement the whole, each other, you have the agreement, you have the drawings, you have the specs, you may have other pieces, so they're complementary of each other. And this requires that before starting each portion of the work, the contractor carefully study and compare the various contract documents relative to the work, the information provided by the owner, so surveys and geotech reports and everything else. Contractor has to take field measurements of any conditions and shall observe conditions of the site affecting it. So this is this again. I'm taking this whole thing into consideration. I, as the contractor, now have obligations I must fulfill to say, yes, I know what I'm building, I know how I'm building it, and I know how these pieces, these drawings, the specs, everything fits together. And I am warranting that I can do this under this contract. That's an owner side provision. And here's the next provision that says this is what the contractor pushes back. These obligations that's stated above are facilitating coordination and construction, but are not for the purposes of discovering errors, omissions, or inconsistencies. So it's like, yeah, you want me to look at all these and put them together and make sure they connect, but if there's a design error, that's not my job. Or if someone didn't coordinate, the drawings say one thing and the specifications say the other, and they both seem legitimate, but they don't match when you put them together, hey, I'm not going to be checking the math there. That's not my obligation. That's somebody else. So the contractor says, yeah, I'll do what you want in 3.2.2, the beginning of it. I'll look around. I'll do my comparisons and everything else, constructability. But I'm not checking the math. So the contractor pushes back. And then the owner pushes back one more time. Says, however, the contractor shall promptly report to the architect any errors, inconsistencies, or omissions discovered or made known to. So while you're not looking at it specifically to find them, if you see them, you need to raise your hand. So it doesn't go so far as, again, this obligation in the first part, kind of pull it back in the second part by the contractor, but they can't completely turn a blind eye. If they see it, because they're contractors and they build things all the time, or if someone tells them about it, Hey, the kitchen designer comes to the contractor and says, you know, I'm starting to work on my kitchen design here, and I'm looking at what the architect has done, and this doesn't seem right. And the kitchen designer tells the contractor that. Maybe the contractor didn't even notice it. But if the kitchen designer tells the contractor has to report it. So it's if the contractor discovers it, or somehow it's made known to them. Maybe a subcontractor comes to the contractor, the general contractor, and says, something's off with these drawings. Contractor has the obligation, because it was made known to them, to inform the architect, something's not here, something's not right. So it's again this push-pull as to who has obligations. Contractor doesn't have to check the math, but they can't forget that math exists, I guess is the best way to think about it. Any questions on this? This is kind of important in understanding the role, the hats they're wearing on the project. Any questions on this? Okay, good. 3.2.3, the contractor is not required to ascertain that the contract documents are in accordance with applicable laws, statute, ordinance, and codes. So again, I don't have to go back and see that the snow loads to which the architect designed the roof structure system are properly adhered to. I don't have to look at that. But the architect shall promptly report to, or the contractor shall promptly report to the architect any nonconformity discovered or made known. So it's the same thing as 3.2.2. It's, hey, I don't have to go and check to make sure your contract documents follow the rules and the laws, but if I know about them or I discover them, I got to let you know. So, and you know, the way I also, what I try to do, for 3.2.2 and 3.2.3, in my contracts, I have an additional language that I stick in there that puts a little more obligation on the contractor. And they always push back on me on it, and I've had long discussions with them because they're saying, look, you're already putting too much burden on me already under this contract. You know, I have to tell you about some nonconformity and all this other stuff. You're already, like, why are you putting more on me? And I look at them and I say, well, because your job is to build a safe building. So, of course, I shouldn't even have to have in this contract that you should report to me if there's a nonconformity. Of course you should do that. That's just good practice. And that's why you're a good contractor. I'm just making sure you understand the rules or the parameters around what that nonconformity is. And I add a little standard of care language, kind of similar, that similarly situated language for the architect. Do you guys remember in 2.2 from the B101? I add it here. I say, was made known or should have known by a similarly situated contractor in a similarly situated project. I just say, guys, I'm just kind of clarifying what you guys have to tell me. I still get squabbles on it from time to time because contractors don't like feeling like they're a design professional, but I also tell them, come on, guys, you just build a good building, then you don't have to worry about this. So that's what the moment goes in the discussion. Any questions on this obligation of, I don't have to check the math, but I can't forget that math exists type concept? Okay. 3.2.4. If the contractor believes that additional costs or times are involved because of clarifications or instructions the architect issues, the contractor can submit claims provided in Article 15. So it's basically saying is, you gave me these drawings, there wasn't enough, but I maybe issued an RFI, and you gave me instructions or clarifications. That's the architect's response. And because of those clarifications, the pots that we were talking about, the tree pots at Navy Pier, your drawings didn't have enough, and now I'm going to have to spend literally millions of more dollars for all these pots total. I need more money. So they submitted a claim. Actually, they initially submitted a change order, and then the change order was denied, so it became a claim under Article 15. That's what they can do. However, and that makes sense, because if I have to spend more money as the contractor and your drawings weren't good enough, then why should I have to carry that load? That's the architect's fault. And the owner should have to pay me for it. However, the owner has a little pushback here. It says if the contractor fails to perform the obligations under 3.2.2 or 3.2.3, meaning I looked and I did my coordination and all this other stuff, then the contractor shall pay costs and damages to the owner subject to 15.1.7, which is just another provision, that would have been avoided if the contractor performed such obligations. So this thing, this is the first time in the contract where now we see, again, another spot where there could be a dispute. we go back to, I think it's 1.5. Remember the language I talked about for the reasonably inferable? You know, the contract, the contract drawings are what's reasonably inferable in this project and what's given, and that's what you have to build to. So that's where this that provision ties into 3.2.4. Basically, what happens is the contractor gets the drawings, says, "Hey, I don't know how to build these pots." And he sends out a request for information for the architect, and the architect comes back and says, "Here's how you build them." And the contractor comes back and says, "That's going to be another $3 million. The contract said another $3 million. The architect then gets a phone call from the owner. "What the heck? Why do I have to spend $3 million more on these pots? What did you do wrong? Why are we like this? What happened?" And the architect may say, "Well, you know what? It was reasonably inferable that the contractor should have known how to build these pots. And I don't think the contractor did the obligations under 3.2.2 and 3.2.3. I don't think they linked all of the drawings and specifications and information we provided together. So I think their request for the $3 million change order was improper." So the contractor, if it ends up being true that the contractor didn't coordinate the drawings in the beginning, didn't do its stuff under 3.2.2 and 3.2.3, the contractor has to pay the cost of damages, which include attorney fees and other stuff, to solve this dispute. So this is how 3.2.4 as a provision works with that reasonably inferable language earlier in Article 1. That makes sense? Okay. You guys are quiet this morning. Normally I get a few more questions by now. 3.3, supervision and construction procedures. So now we're going to start building the project. So you got to supervise and direct the work using your best skill and attention. Now this is always this best skill and attention language up here. Always is a hot button for contractors. And they're like, "Wait a minute. You're asking me to be the best contractor there is. I'm just a normal contractor, reasonably situated, similarly situated for a similar project. I'm just going to be that. Why do I have to be the best contractor?" Well, that's not what this says. This says you're using the contractor's best skill and attention. And that's effectively saying that for any contract, when you're supervising and directing your work, you have to be the best at supervising your own work. How you are working. It's not, you're not, this doesn't say it's the best contractor. It's using the contractor's best skill. So, I always get, what helps is since this is a standardized form, I don't get as much pushback here. But when I create my own forms and I use this exact same language, people always get all wigged out about it. And they're like, "You know what, go back and look at every form contract there is. I'm not saying you're the best contractor. I'm just saying you have to do your best skill." So, then we get in some other guts. So here's something you're going to see that you saw in the B101, only it was the opposite. Here it says, "The contractor shall be solely responsible for and have control over construction's means, methods, techniques, sequences, procedures." If you remember, in the B101, it says the architect has no responsibility for this. It makes sense, because the contractor is solely responsible. Now, it's also relevant that the contractor is solely responsible, and neither is the owner. So not only does the architect not have the responsibility, but neither does the owner. So means, methods, how we build it, how we use that torque wrench, how we hammer that nail, those are the single and sole purview of the contractor. Okay? Now, let's say the contract documents give specific instructions on how to build something. So maybe the architect, maybe it's the curtain wall designer, maybe it's some specialty thing, but the architect still says, "Well, I'm going to tell you how to build this," which happens. Some designers have very specific details of how they want something to come together. And that's fine. Then the architect is taking some more responsibility, but knowing that they're doing it. In that instance, the contractor still has an obligation to make sure that what they're being instructed to do is with job site safety. So they shall evaluate the job site safety thereof. So if the contractor's told how to build something, they need to make sure it's safe. And then finally in this provision it says the contractor shall be solely responsible for job site safety. of such means, methods, techniques, sequence, and procedures. So once we know we're going to do that, once we're told how to do it or we're doing it ourselves, all safety obligations are on the contractor. And again, that's similar to the opposite in the AI in the B101. The architect has no job site safety. So we can see where people's hats are, whose hat people are wearing on this project. Okay? Last part of this bulk that's, I know there's a lot highlighted in this, italicized in this slide, but this is like a very, very important slide as far as who does what. If the contractor determines that such means, methods, blah, 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 may not be safe. So if she's told how to build it and does the evaluation, if the contractor determines they're not safe, the contractor has to notify the owner and the architect and propose alternate means. You want me to put this truss together in a specific way. Okay, you've told me how to do it. I've done my analysis. I think it's not safe. Here's how I think you should build it. Let's sit down and hash this out. You can't turn the blind eye, again, going back to kind of like 322 and 323, if you think something's not right, you can't just say, hear no evil, see no evil, say no evil. You can't do that. You have to speak up. Because you're the builder. You're the contractor. And then, ultimately, the architect evaluates the alternate supply, the alternate method, and unless the architect objects the alternate method, the contractor goes ahead and performs the work. So it's this combination of how everybody works together to get the project built. Okay? 3.2. Contractor shall be responsible to the owner for the acts and omissions of the contractor's employees, subcontractors, agents, and whatever. So think about back. Let's go back to our triangle. So we have on the top, we have the owner, and we have the single line to the contractor and to the corner of the triangle. But the contractor's not doing all the work. They got all these little subcontractors down underneath here. Okay, you got your plumber and your electrician and your rough carpenter and your finished carpenter and all these other drywall, whoever's going to do all the work. And so in your triangle, owner, architect, owner, contractor, and under the contractor, there's a whole bunch of solid lines to all these trades. But the owner has no solid line to any of these trades. So the owner has no contract with any of them. So what the owner wants, and that's what 3.3.2 says, is the owner says, I look to you, contractor, for everything. And you have this big umbrella under which all your subs sit. So if your electrician screws up, I don't have to sue the electrician because 3.3.2 says, I can go after you because you're responsible for your electrician, or anybody under that umbrella. Whoever sits under your umbrella, it's your problem, not mine. I'm just going to go after you. So that's 3.3.2. Single point responsibility is the best way to kind of think about that. Okay? Where's my cursor? 3.4. Labor materials. So this kind of talks about under 3.4.2. If there are minor changes, the contractor can make substitutions. So basically, you know what, if I want to use a different type of paint, you know, I'm not going to use Sherwin-Williams, I'm going to use some other type of paint company, maybe Behr or whatever, you can make a substitution. The architect may look at it, there may be a change order, but you can have, except we can have minor changes, and it's all done through Article 7, which we'll talk about next or 2 weeks from now, works on how a change order works. 3.4.3, you have to have strict discipline and good order on the site. You got to make sure the site just is done well and everybody's working in good proper order on that. 3.5 is important warranty. Okay, so there are two sections in this contract that talks about warranty. There's Article 3.5 or Section 3.5, and then there's like 12.2.1. 12.2.1 talks about how long the warranty lasts. So, you know, do you have a 1 year, do you have a 5 year, do you have a 10 year? So that's a time period of how long the warranty is in place. 3.5 is what are you actually promising? A warranty is just a promise. So what we say under 3.5, I, contractor, warrant, promise to the owner that the materials and equipment furnished under the contract will be of good quality and new, unless the contract requires or permit otherwise. So, like, maybe you're putting in old growth wood or not reconstituted wood, but like, you know, where people go and they tear up an old barn and they use that wood to have a new floor or whatever. So maybe you don't have to use new stuff there. But other than that, you're promising that the owner, what I'm building for you is good quality and new. That's a promise. And they will conform to the requirements of the contract documents and be free, completely, 100% free from defects. Except those inherent in the quality of the work and the contract documents require a permit. So there may be some little defects, like because the wood may not be perfect, or you know, maybe you know, the corner may not be 100%. But basically, you're saying under this warranty, hey, I'm giving you a good brand new building, and it's not going to be crooked, it's not going to leak, it's not going to tilt, it's not going to have where the doors can't open, or all those other things. I am warranting, I'm promising you that I'm doing this under the 3-5 warranty. Now, contractor pushes back and says, okay, yeah, I promise you that, but wait a minute, I'm not going to give you a remedy or damage if it's somebody abused, altered my work, not by done by me, or you didn't have proper maintenance or whatever, and normal wear and tear. So, like, sure, I'm going to give you a refrigerator that's going to work properly, but if you leave the door open 24 hours a day and the motor burns out, that's not my problem because it was not proper operation. Or if your furnace, you never come in and clean the furnace or whatever the piece of the pump or other equipment is, and you don't do proper maintenance, I'm not going to give my warranty on that. Or if I install a metal roof and the next contractor that's coming on to do other work stomps across that metal roof and damages it and dents it, well, my warranty doesn't go to that. So it was new when I put it in. It was good quality. But if somebody else damages it, not my problem. So that's what this kind of pullback is in the second part of 351. And then 352 is all material equipment or other special warranties. So this is the actual paper, this warranty. Shall be issued in the name of the owner or shall be transferable to the owner. So, you know, like when you get a car, you know, you get a three-year or 30,000-mile warranty, or when you get, you know, when you go buy something at an appliance store, when you buy something off of Amazon, they always ask you, like, you want to spend another $9.95 for a two-year replacement warranty. That's what this is also talking about here in 352. That warranty, that whatever that specific obligation is issued in the name of the owner, or can be transferred to the owner. Sometimes, and I have this on a project right now, a piece of litigation right now, sometimes the manufacturer, the warranty will say, this warranty is issued to the purchaser. And so if the owner doesn't purchase the windows directly, but the contractor purchases them and gets reimbursed for them, so technically the warranty runs to the contractor, because the warranty says this warranty goes to the purchaser. But 352 says it shall be transferable. So regardless of whether the first part of that warranty from manufacturer goes to the contractor, the purchaser, the contractor must be able to assign from that warranty to the owner. Okay? Any questions on that? One other piece, and again, we'll talk about more when we get to Article 12 in 2 weeks from now, but these promises, this warranty, has kind of a dual part impact under the contract for legal purposes. You don't have to worry about this for the exam, but I just want to kind of explain it to you. If I build a building and it leaks, as long as the design was correct, I'm in breach of contract because I haven't built the building in accordance with the plans and specifications. Because it leaks. And it shouldn't. And I can be sued because I breached the contract, and the owner can recover damages to pay for the fix to the leaky roof. Okay? The warranty, which is talked about here under 3.5, is saying, I'm going to build you a roof that doesn't leak, and it's going to have new and good qualities, and it's going to conform with the contract documents. And because it's free from defects, and when you couple it with the period, the time period in Article 12, if it's a one-year warranty, I need to come out, I as the contractor, need to come out and fix it for free. And the owner shouldn't have to sue because it's within that first year. Now, if it's outside of the first year, I don't have to come back and fix it for free at all. If I want to fix it, I can, but I don't have to. And then it's just a breach of contract action. So sometimes I will have lawsuits where count one will say, you build me a roof, a leaky roof, breach of contract. Count two says, you didn't come out for your warranty during that first year when I told you it was a leaky roof, breach of warranty. So now I have two separate claims for the same leaky roof. So it's a legal kind of technicality, but I want you to understand when you couple Article 3.5 with Article 12.2, there's a time period of when that warranty for free work exists. Okay? 3.7. Permits and fees, notice. So this is, so remember in three, under Article 2, there were certain things the owner had to do, like surveys and easements and stuff. Well, here, this says the contractor needs to pay for the building permit because they're the ones that are going to be doing the building. Owner will reimburse them for it. Contractor should give notices required by laws and statutes and codes. So if they have to inform the local neighbors that they're working, or if they have to inform the city that they're performing work, or whatever the contractor's obligations with the laws, they're required to give those notices. That's in 372. And then 373 says if the contractor performs work knowing it to be contrary to the applicable laws, then the contractor shall assume appropriate responsibility for such work. So think of it this way. The owner has to get the permits and the easements and everything to make sure the project is being built. But the contractor has to get the permits and follow the laws with what its work is. I'm going to build, so I take care of securing the building permit. I'm going to be on site, so I need to make sure I'm in compliance with OSHA for safety, or I'm in compliance with, heck, it depends on what state you're in, I'm in compliance with all the protocols for COVID, or whatever it might be. So I, contractor, though I can kind of turn a blind eye to other, whether the architect is following the rules and laws and codes, for my work with a capital W, I have to follow the rules and laws that affect my work. So we can't completely ignore the law. They just only have to be responsible for the law related to what they're doing. And 373 says if you screw up, hey, it's you're dying. You're a responsibility. If you violate the law, and you were supposed to know it, and you violate it, well, it's your cost. You have to figure it out. So if you violate OSHA, what ends up happening on this one, let's say that they have an unsafe work site and they violate OSHA, the owner may get fined. Well, that's the contractor's responsibility because the contractor is responsible for safety, that's a code, and it says they're in violation of the law here. Okay? 374, concealed or unknown conditions. So sometimes, I mean, you can imagine, obviously when you're digging, you don't know what's underground, so there's going to be lots of stuff that you can't see. So if the contractor encounters conditions to the site, the different material of those are ordinarily found to exist. So, hey, you gave me a survey, you gave me some soil samples, I started digging, and I found an Indian burial ground. I had no idea it was going to be there. Well, you got to give owner, who knew? It's material differently. Or maybe there's a gas pipe in there you didn't know about, or who knows? There's something down there that nobody knew. It says the contractor shall promptly provide notice to the owner and the architect before the conditions are disturbed, and no event later than 14 days after the first observance of the conditions. So you got to promptly kind of step up and say, wait a minute, I found a dead cemetery here. I found pipes here that shouldn't have been there. I actually had a project in Streeter, Illinois, where that whole town, that actually whole region of Illinois is over old mines, not actual man-made mines, but mines that are just caverns and tunnels due to geotechnical movement of the land. And so there would be sinkholes. So you probably see, like, occasionally on the news, like in Florida, there's lots of sinkholes where all, like, cars will be swallowed. Well, this was like this in Streator, and 50 years ago, whatever, there was actually buildings that had collapsed down in. And so I was working with a project where they were building a drugstore. And they started digging up, and they found literally a whole house underground. And it was like the whole house was there. I don't know what happened, but they backfilled it. When the house sunk, instead of them taking all the wood out and everything else, they backfilled over the house and tamped it down. But there were still gaps, literally, from where the rooms were and the boiler and stuff. And so they were digging, like, all of a sudden the soil, they were putting in gravel and everything, they just kept pouring gravel and gravel and gravel in this little, what they thought was a little hole. And what they later found out is that gravel was going into, like, the old living room of this house and filling it up because there was this big gap. Well, that's an unknown and concealed condition. And the contractor kind of said, hey, we keep pouring in literally yards of gravel and it's not working, so we needed to stop, and we had to go in. And it was quite costly to the owner because nobody knew it was underneath there. But they had to promptly notify us, and it materially differed from what's ordinary on the site. Same thing, if the architecture promptly informed the owner and contractor, and if there's a dispute over how the resolution is, you go to Article 15 to make a claim. And that's we didn't have a dispute over what the claim. There wasn't a claim. It was just like, oh my God, how are we going to fix this? It was a nightmare. So, and then this one talks about specifically about existence of burial markers, archaeological sites, and everything. Here, it's not within 14 days. Here, the contractor shall immediately suspend any operations with effect and notify the owner of the architect. So you got to stop immediately if there's the burial site. McCormick Place, if you guys are familiar with the lake one, not the west building, but the one that's on the lake, they found Indian burial remains there when they were initially building that back in the 60s. So they had to stop work and relocate some of those things. So, okay. Moving on. Article 3.8, allowances. So allowance is the type of thing when we're trying to figure out pricing. We want to make sure we're putting together this contract sum. See how the contract sum here is capitalized? This is the cost of the work. This is your total contract sum to build a project. My $10 million to build my toy factory. Maybe in my design, maybe in the design drawings they're giving me, let me use a different example for this. Let's use the house. Let's use the $1 million house, okay? So I know I can build this house for $1 million, and I know it's going to have an upscale kitchen. But the owner hasn't decided yet. Did I lose you guys? Oh, crap. Did I lose you guys? I see you now. Are you back? Okay, good. All right. That was weird. My internet. We're probably because we have my son on, my wife on, mine on. I don't even know. All right, but we're back. So I don't know when I lost you, but what I was talking about is, let's say you're doing $1 million house here, and you know there's going to be an upscale kitchen. The owner hasn't decided, well, I'm either going to be using Sub-Zero or Wolf appliances. Am I using stainless or black? Like, I'm not sure what I want to do. I'm not sure, but so the contractor says, well, I think this kitchen's going to be like $20,000 for the appliances. So I'm going to stick in a placeholder in my pricing for the project called an allowance for the appliances for this kitchen. So it shall cover the cost of the contractor and materials and equipment delivered at the site. So this is the cost. And then if there are more or less, then the contract sum should be adjusted. So if it ends up when I build my house, that I end up spending $25,000 for my kitchen, well, then my $1 million price automatically goes to $1,005,000. I get that one because my allowance was, hey, you gave me the best estimate, but I couldn't figure out exactly what you wanted. So that's what this thing is, this concept of allowances are. It's an important in just the accounting part of the project. Oh, is this working? Did I lose you guys again?
I think just you're trying to understand.
Oh, okay. Let me do that. All right, hold on. I'm gonna find it. Give me a second here. There. Is it back?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so we just finished allowances. Just know that it's a placeholder for pricing for cost if you don't know what the total price of something is. 3.9, superintendent, that's going to be like your lead person on the project site. So you got to have a superintendent. That's what 3.9.1 says. And the superintendent shall represent the contractor. So the superintendent here by language is the agent. And communications to the superintendent shall be binding. So this is agency language. You know that the superintendent is the agent of the contractor. Okay? Contractor on 3.9.2 shall notify the owner of the name and the qualifications of the superintendent. And so maybe the owner may have to object, maybe not. So if you object within 14 days, then you have to get a different superintendent. So that's what 3.9.2 is. I am really stressing out about my... You guys there? Are you back?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Hold on, I got some chats here. Very soon. Okay, great. Thanks. And then 3.9.3 says, contractor shall not be charged, shall not change a superintendent without owner's consent. You just want to make sure, hey, I got the right people in the project, we're all working together, you can't change the rule, the players of the game. Construction and submittal schedules. If you remember, we talked a little bit about submittals in the B101. It says, hey, we're going to, a submittal, as you remember, is like shop drawings or samples, like is it this brick or this brick or what have you. So the contractor and the architect, the owner shall work together to create this submittal schedule of when I'm going to be getting these submittals. So like in the beginning, I'm going to be getting submittals on the types of concrete to be used because we're pouring the foundations. Then I'm going to be getting submittals on the type of wood and steel. As we get later on to the project, we're getting submittals for the type of paints or bricks or what have you. So it works with a progression of as the project is going on. It leads. It's in front of the work being performed. I'm going to look at a brick. I'm going to approve the brick. Then the contractor is going to buy the brick, and then eventually in the actual construction schedule, they're going to build the brick wall. So that's just what talks about in 3.10.1 is this schedule and has the information, starting the work, so forth and so on, and the construction submittal schedules, okay? Oh, I'm sorry, actually 3.10.1 specifically is the construction schedule. Submittals is coming up in a second, but it's the same thing. When do we start work in the construction schedule? What are your milestone dates, the important dates? Date of substantial completion, that's a key part in the end of the project. So that's your. This is the overall construction schedule. We'll get to some middle schedules in a second. But it's a contractual term under 3.10.1 that we're creating a schedule for the work. 3.10.2, after being awarded the contract, then you do the submittal schedule. So 3.10.2. And the submittal schedule needs to be approved by the architect. So that doubles back, as I said, to what was in the B101. Allows for coordination of getting those elements prior to the construction being performed. 3.10.3, documents and samples at the sites. I'm sorry, 3.10.3, 3.11, I apologize. You need to make available on site, you have to have anything in your change orders, construction change directives, shop drawings, product samples. So if anybody comes to visit the site, if the owner or somebody from the city or some other representative or whatever, that information needs to all be at the project site. It can't be at home at the contractor's home office. Simple, it's pretty common. I mean, why would you be building a building without the drawings in hand? But at the same time, it's just this is stating. Everything needs to be there. If I want to go there and go to the project site, I'm going to see the brick samples there. So forth. Okay? There'll be a room or a trailer that's set up just for this type of information, and sometimes it's electronic, but a lot of it's physical samples for every project. 312, shop drawing, product data, and samples. So this talks about what a shop drawing is, their drawings and diagrams, what's the product data. These are like little brochures and information about, you know, what's that brick made out of. And then samples are the physical samples. So all three of these things are elements that are the obligation of the contractor to bring to the site. Architect is going to do a specification, says you're going to build a brick wall and you're going to use bricks that follow this specification, and now the contractor has to come back and have the samples of those bricks, the product data and how the bricks were created, and maybe the shop drawings of how the connections of the brick wall to, I don't know, where the window is or where the steel support behind it or what have you. There would be shop drawings on how those things, those components fit together. That's all done by the contractor. It talks about their submittals. They are not contract documents. So they are specifically not something that if they fail to do, they are in breach of contract. But their purpose is to demonstrate, and I'll read right here, how the contractor proposes to conform to the information and the design concept expressed in the contract documents. Which sounds pretty similar to what the architect is supposed to be doing when the architect's walking around the site. They're like, I'm looking at the project and I want to make sure that what's being built conforms with the intent of my contract documents. And the contract says what I'm building is going to conform to the design concept expressed. So it's not, everything's not going to be perfect. Yes, I'm going to give you as the contractor new and good quality materials. But if I'm off by an inch here or there, it's not going to be perfect. It just has to be conform with the information given in the design concepts. That's what the shop drawing information does. Okay? And submittals are not required by the contract actions, may be returned by the architect without action. So what this means is, I have a submittal schedule and I'm going to give you, you know, this stuff on the wood and this stuff on the brick and this stuff on the steel. And if the architect has sent more than what's on the submittal schedule, architect says, well, thank you for sending that, but if I didn't ask for it, I'm just going to return it back to you. I don't have to approve it or bless it or anything else. That's what the second sentence says. Contractors shall review for compliance with the contract documents and approve and submit to the architect these shop drawings, what have you. So they're going to get the shop drawings and product data from their subs, the general contractor is. They're going to take a look at it and make sure that it's complies with the contract documents, and they give it to the architect. It has to be done with reasonable promptness and in such sequence, that's what your submittal schedule is, the timing of the schedule, to cause no delay to the work. So it's this process that kind of rolls throughout the project. You have a submittal schedule, submittal log. I look at it. I give the drawings to the subcontractor. They create their shop drawings and product data. They give it back to me. Then I have to give. Then I review it. Then I give it to the architect. The architect has to bless it. Then I get to build it. And so this kind of rolling time frame, and all that has legal obligations to not cause delays of the work. Okay. And then 312.6, separate from the architect's duty or different from the architect's duty, so the contractor represents to owner and architect that they reviewed and approved them, they've determined and verified materials, taken field measurements, and they checked and coordinated the information contained in. So while they're not a contract document, the contractor still is making a representation and warranty that they've done their job to make sure that they're in compliance with the intent of the design. Okay? And this is where 312.6 is where if something falls down, if that wall falls down and it has to do with improper shop drawings, this is where you go after the contractor and say, you didn't do your job in reviewing and approving or verified or checked and coordinated. You didn't do what you were supposed to do under 312.6, so therefore you're in breach of contract. You're not in breach of contract because the shop drawing was drawn incorrectly. It's because you didn't do your job in checking the math yourself. Okay? Contractors shall perform no proportion of the work for which contract documents require submittal until they've been approved by the architect. So if you have to have a submittal, I'm not going to, you want to approve that brick for the brick wall, or the bolt pattern for the steel riser or whatever it might be. Until you get the approval by the architect, you can't do that work. You can't go forward. And so sometimes that's where you get into a dispute of who's causing a delay. I gave it to the submittal to the architect timely. They haven't returned it to me. 312.7 says I can't keep working. So there's a delay of the project. Look to your architect, not me. Architect may say, well, what they gave you was improper. So I've returned it. It's improper. So the delay is them. It goes back and forth on this. 312.8, the contractor shall not be relieved of responsibility from deviations of the requirement of the contract documents by the architect's approval of the shop drawings. So if you remember, I said this a bunch of times, the architect's not checking the math of the shop drawings. So just because the architect approved a submittal doesn't mean the contractor gets out of responsibility if the wall falls down. So architect's approval does not relieve contractor's obligations. Unless, and here we go with the contractor's pushback, unless the contractor has specifically notified the architect in writing of such deviation, and the architect has given an approval, or a change order has been issued authorizing such deviation. So sometimes the contractor says, okay, look, you want this type of brick. Here's three bricks. None of them meet your standards, what you needed for the color or the composition. But these are three that we have used in the field that we think are pretty good and that they have worked consistently. If the architect says, yeah, you can go ahead and use brick one, well then, there is a but it's not in compliance with the drawings. So if the brick fails, the architect's going to say, well, or the contractor's going to say, but you approved it. So I'm not responsible. So we get into this question about if the architect approves the deviation or there's a change order approving the deviation, then the contractor doesn't have the responsibility. Potentially. Then it says in the last part, the contractor shall not be relieved of responsibilities for errors or omissions, spot drawing, blah, 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 by the architect's approval thereof. So this part here says, if I give you, let's say I give you a submittal that's not in compliance with the drawings, it's not the right color of brick, but here's the data on that brick. The architect approves that brick. But if the data that the contractor gave the architect itself was an error, then they're not relieved. So it's like, you want me to do A, I can't find A. Here's a suggestion for B. The architect approved B and everything works fine. The contractor's not in breach just because he didn't provide A. But if when I gave B to the architect to look at and B had errors in it and it fails, then the contractor can be liable for submitting the B even though the architect approved it because the contractor gave an error-ridden information. So this kind of comes and goes on this provision. It's a little confusing, but try to make it simple of who's responsible for what. And the last under 312, I believe. No, a couple more. We're at 312.9. We'll skip over that. 312.10. The contractor should not be required to provide professional services that constitute the practice of architecture engineering unless such services are specifically required in the contract documents. So what 312.10 says is, I'm a contractor, not an architect. That's your job. That's your hat that you wear. And I don't need to worry about designing something specifically. Unless there may be stuff in this design that's specifically called for that I need to provide an architect. So a lot of times that could be fire protection systems, curtain wall systems. There are some things that the architects don't design because the company that manufactures those systems keep it in-house proprietary. Like I said, fire protection systems is a common one. Architects just say, we need a fire protection system, it's a wet system, it needs to cover this much square footage, it needs to comply with these codes. So it gives kind of a performance spec. Contractor goes out and gets bids from three different fire protection system companies, and they do the design. But the contractor's hiring them, so they have their own engineers doing that work. So unless they have to provide that, the contractor, in order to carry out the responsibility for public service, the contractor needs to provide this service. Yeah. And then the contractor shall not be required to provide professional services in violation of applicable law. So there may be times when the architect says the contractor needs to provide this type of engineer regardless, and if they need to have a certain seal or other type of legal issues or whatever, or maybe that the law says this is something that cannot be delegated to the contractor, then the contractor is not required to go out and get the engineer. Mostly 312.10, you want to think about, like I said, fire protection, curtain walls, sometimes when you're digging near another facility, like shoring and bracing to make sure there's not, like if you dig too close to a building, that ground doesn't collapse away and cause the foundations next door to deteriorate. Limited times that you're going to have the contractor doing design services under this contract. 312.10.1. The owner and the architect will specify all performance and design criteria that such services must satisfy. So this is basically saying, if we're going to have a system that we're requiring the contractor to get their own design professional, we will tell you what those systems are, and we will give you the performance criteria of those systems. So my example of the fire protection, the owner and the architect's drawings are going to say, we need a wet fire protection system or a dry fire protection system. It needs to comply with these codes, it needs to cover this square footage, it needs to have this response time, or whatever the specifications. That's the performance and design criteria that we're telling the contractor under 312.10.1 what they need to hire. And the contractor can rely on those adequacy and accuracy. Yes, I believe the architect got the right code number and the right type of system, so now I just need to go out and get my own fire protection company to provide that. And if it turns out it's not in compliance with the law, it's the architect's fault, not mine, because I relied on the accuracy of the contractor, of the architect. Shop drawings, let me see if we need anything in this contract. Oh, 312.10.2. If the contract documents require design professionals to certify the work has been performed in accordance with the design criteria, the contractor has to provide such certification. So what this is saying is, so if you remember the B101, you have to walk around and certify a pay app. Yes, I looked at the project and I certified that the work that was performed was done in conformance with the design intent for that pay app. And then when you get the substantial completion, you certify at the end of the project that the project was built in accordance with the design intent of the contract documents. So that's your job as an architect, of certifying the work using your design. In this instance, what this is saying is, if there's some work that's being performed by the contractor's design professional that's related to it, the installation of the fire protection system or something to that effect, the contractor has to figure out how to provide those certifications, because the architect can't certify it. They're not part of the design. So the contractor has to bring in their design professional to certify that the work has been done properly here. And that may come up in the interim, in the middle of a project, because the fire protection system is being installed before the project is completed, as well as at substantial completion. If there's certain things that linger on, the contractor's design professional has to certify the work is in conformance with their design criteria. Same kind of obligation as the B101. 313, 314, you can skip. Cleaning up access to the work, same thing. It's just, you know, pretty basic. You can clean up a site. Owner and architect should have access to the site. You can skip over those. 317. Actually, why don't we do this? Let me see how many we got left. Let's take a quick break here for like 5 minutes. Everybody can get up and walk around. And then we'll come back and finish up the last of it. Okay? So we'll see you. It's 11 o'clock. We'll see you in 5 minutes. 11:05.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, I'm back. 317. So this is just where are these patents and copyrights? So this is this talks about, you know, we talked about the owner is going to be doing the licensing fees or what have you with the architect for drawings. But sometimes there may be work that the contractor is going to be using and pay that they may have to have their own licensing fees. So let's say that they're installing, let's go back to this this fire protection system. There may be specific licenses that the contractor must procure from the fire protection system designer, and they would have to pay whatever license fees they have there. Or for some of the projects I work on, sometimes there's specialty construction systems or manufacturing systems that are installed, pumps and assembly lines and how this equipment comes together. And again, there may be license fees and royalties that have to be paid for the contractor to build the project. And so the contractor is responsible to pay those fees, and that's what talks about here. The owner will be reimbursed them, but the contractor needs to be the first person that writes the check. And then if there's any infringement or claims of infringement that that some third party says to the contractor, you're building this system, but it's proprietary to me and you never gave me a license for that, but they sue the owner because the system's in the owner's building, the contractor shall defend and indemnify for these claims of copyright. So they have to step in and say, I will protect you, owner, because I should have procured or obtained the license and paid the fees to build this system into your building. So that's what 317 is talking about. 318, we talked about this before. This is indemnity. I'm just going to talk about it very briefly. You will not be tested on indemnity. Indemnity is something that always is confusing to everybody. I just had a discussion with one of my clients, a very, very bright individual, about indemnity, and we had like polar opposite opinions on what it means on certain parts of it. So just know that the contractor, and we talked a little bit about this before when we were talking about insurance and everything else. But what 318 talks about, 318.1 and 318.2, is the contractor is going to perform its work, and the contractor is responsible for itself and its subcontractors. That's what it says, contractor and subcontractor, or anyone directly or indirectly employed by them. So the contractor has this people under their umbrella, and they're going to perform their work. And if a third party gets injured, somebody has a bodily injury, or there's injury or destruction to the tangible party other than the actual work. So maybe the next door neighbor, there's a fire, or the property is damaged as opposed to the work. Maybe the project is damaged as opposed to the work. Due to the negligent acts or omissions of the contractor. So if I do my work as a contractor and I screw up, hold on a second here. Oh, let me answer your question in a second. So where the question was, superintendent, is the superintendent the agent of the contractor? Yes. The superintendent is an agent of the contractor. They actually work for the contractor, but the language in that paragraph, the section of the superintendent, specifically says that the decisions and actions of the superintendent are binding on the contractor. So in fact, that language of binding means that they are an agent. Sorry, I didn't see that question earlier. So let me finish real quick. So if some third party gets injured, what the indemnity clause says is, I, contractor, if someone's injured because of my screw-up on my work, but the owner gets sued, I mean, I'll probably get sued myself as the contractor, but if the owner, the architects, or the architect consultants as agents, if this list of people in the second line here gets sued, the contractor will say, I will indemnify you and hold harmless, meaning I will pay for, if there's a claim against you, and they say you owe $1 million, but it's due to my acts or omissions, I have to pay the $1 million, whether it's directly to the injured party or pay you back because you paid the injured party. And I have to pay for your legal fees. So that's what this is, an indemnification. It's when another party gets sued for your work, you protect that other party. And then 318.2 is just a little bit more about indemnity. So you don't need to worry about that for the exam. It's just remember that as a concept that anytime indemnity comes up, it's you're not sued, but somebody with whom you have a contract, so in this case, contracted with owner, the owner gets sued for your screw-ups, whatever costs and expenses the owner incurs, because that other person sued the owner, I, as the contractor, have to pay the owner's costs and expenses that flow to the injured party. Okay? All right, so that's it on the obligations of the contractor. That's the biggest, by the way, that's the biggest section of the entire agreement, Article 3. Now we'll go through Article 4 a little more quickly, because a lot of the stuff's going to sound familiar, because it's familiar. It's going to be just what you saw on the B-101, but we want to make sure, well, the B-101, you know what your duties and obligations are, because you have that contract, the solid line over here on this side of the triangle, with you and the owner. You know what hats you're wearing and everything else. We need to tell the contractor of what you're doing. And in fact, Article 4, it kind of creates the dotted line that's the bottom of the triangle. It tells the contractor in the solid line, the contract, what the architect's doing. But remember, only in certain instances is the owner, the architect, acting as the owner's agent. So it's just like this informational process. So that's what we're going to do in Article 4. We'll talk about it. Okay. So, 412. Duties, responsibilities, and limitations of authority of the architect to set forth the contract document shall not be restricted, modified, or extended without written consent of the owner, contractor, or architect. So basically what this says is, whatever this contract says, and whatever the B-101 says, you can't change any of the limitations of authority. You can't, the owner or the contractor can't say, well, I thought that they were acting as the architect, as the owner's agent, because they were doing this, this, and this. What this is effectively saying in 412 is we can't have apparent authority. We can only have actual authority. Actual authority is in this agreement. It's identified in the B-101. And the only way that the actual authority identified in this and the B-101 can be changed is by written consent of all three parties. So this is an agency issue, should not be restricted, modified, or extended. Can't be changed, is what this says, without all three parties in writing agreeing to the architect's agency obligations. Okay? Administration of the contract. 421. The architect will provide administration of the contract as described in the contract documents and will be the owner's representative during construction. The architect will have authority to act on behalf of the owner only to the extent provided in the contract documents. This is the exact same language as you saw in B-101. Only if it's stated specifically here. And in this instance, it's going to be for the A-201, this contract we're looking at. It's only going to be found in Article 4. Okay? The architect will visit the site at appropriate intervals, otherwise agree to become generally familiar with the progress and quality of the work, determine if the work observed is being performed in a manner indicating that the work, when fully completed, will be in accordance with the contract documents. Same language as the B-101. The architect will not be required to make exhaustive or on-site inspections. They will not have control over, charge of, responsibilities, means, methods, techniques, sequences, or safety. This is the same provision that you saw in the B-101. So nothing new here. It's just letting the contractor know, hey, the architect's not responsible for safety. Architect's not going to go and check under every piece, every rock, and every stone. They're just going to become generally familiar. So let's make sure the contractor knows that these are the duties the architect owes the owner. Okay. 423. Same stuff here. The architect will keep the owner reasonably informed about the progress and quality of the portion of the work completed. They'll promptly report known deviations from the contract documents or from the schedule or defects observed in the work. But they will not be responsible for the contractor's failure to perform the work in accordance with the contract documents. And they will not have control or charge of the contractor or subcontractors for their acts or omissions. So again, what it's saying is, hey, contractor, know that the architect's going to be walking around and looking over your shoulder. And they're going to tell the owner if you change from the contract documents or if you're late on the schedule or if they observe defects. They're going to tell the owner that. But I want you to know that even if they tell the owner that, and even if they see it on the site, and even if they, and no matter what they do, you still, the architect will not be responsible for your failure to perform the work. And they will never be responsible for the acts or omissions of you or your agents. So, they may see you doing something wrong, they may point it out to you, they may point it out to the owner, you still have to do your job. The architect is doing the job it promised the owner. Okay? Or 2.4. Owner and contractor shall include the architect in all communications that relate or affect the architect's services. Owner shall promptly notify the architect of the substance of any direct communication between owner and contractor. And the communications with subcontractors, since we'll stop that for a second. So what the first two parts of this provision says, and this is new, by the way, in the 2017. This did not exist in 2007. Is in the past, and the reason why I'm pointing this out, because sometimes you may be on a project. I still have some projects where they want to use the 2007. Don't ask me why, but they still do. But in the past, what happened was is the contractor, by this contract, was only allowed to communicate questions and answers and information through the architect. So when I got a question, I inform the architect, and the architect informs the owner. Well, what ended up happening, even longer than 10 years ago, lots of times the owner would go on site to take a look at their own project site. And as a result, the contractor and the owner would talk directly. The contractor would say, hey, do you mind if we change this? You know, let's move the soffit a little bit. This, I think, and the owner's like, yeah, go ahead and do it. But the owner's project, they can approve on anything. And then later on, the soffit is a problem, and the owner's like, oh, I got to sue somebody. And the architect says, you didn't tell me. You worked outside of the system. The system was contractor talked to architect, architect talks to the owner, and here, you ran around me. You did an end around. So that became problems over the years. So what this now says is, architect and contractor, owner and architect shall include architects in all communications. So everybody needs to know everything that goes on in the project. And then if there's that end around, the owner shall promptly notify the architect. So if there's that end around, the contractor talks to owner, the owner, by this document, by this provision, needs to promptly notify the architect. We move the soffit. The architect may say, wait, you can't move the soffit because that's going to affect where the fire protection system goes in or where the heating, the HVAC ducts are going to go in. So you can't move that soffit. So there's reasons why this is in here. So it's a change in how the communication, but it's a change reflecting what's really happening in the field. What's happening in the field is all three parties are talking at all different times, so everybody has to be on the same page. Everybody has to be copied in communications. And it's a lot easier now with electronics, electronic communication, but know that it doesn't have to now go contractor, architect, owner. It can go in all different directions. However, that's why I stopped before we went to the last part here. Communications by and with subcontractors and suppliers shall be through the contractor. And communications by and with any separate contractor shall be through the owner. So while we can have contractor talk to owner or contractor talk to architect, and we can have this kind of mix up here, if you ever want to talk to the contractors, subcontractors, nobody can talk to them except for the contractor. So you have to go through the flow of owner, contractor, sub, or architect, contractor, sub. You can't do owner sub or contract architect sub. You can't do the end around. And same thing if the owner brings in their separate kitchen builder, it has to go contractor, owner, separate builder, architect, owner, separate builder. They have to communicate through this channels here. This is important in project management. Fortune 5 just talks about certificates of payment, so they're just like you guys have reviewed in B101, they're going to review and talk about how much they get paid. 426, architect has the authority. Here's the one time where it's specifically stated, authority. So this is the express authority, not apparent. This is when the architect is acting on behalf of the owner. Architect has the authority to reject the work that does not conform with the contract documents. That's an owner agency issue. And the architect will have authority, another time, to require an inspection or testing of the work in accordance with sections 1342 and 1343, whether or not the work is fabricated, installed, or completed. So this would be an example, this required inspection or testing, is if, for example, the architect came and visited the site first 1 week, and they saw the electrician or the plumber doing some of the installation of the plumbing risers coming up into the second story bathroom, and they were like, "It looks okay, but he's not finished. I want to check it out. I want to make sure before they put the drywall up to make sure it's done properly, because I'm not sure if they're getting it right." And then they come back the next week, and all of a sudden the bathroom's completely drywalled. But the architect can, because they have the authority to reject work or stop the work or inspect, can say, "Hey, I need to inspect that where the risers came up. So you need to pull that drywall off so I can see where the piping came in." Because they have the authority to require inspections or testing. So that would be an inspection. Now it says, however, this authority of the architect nor a decision made in good faith either to exercise nor to not exercise this authority shall give a duty or responsibility of the architect to the contractor. So, if the architect in good faith thought there was a problem with the plumber's work and asked the contractor to pull off that drywall, and it turns out that the work was done properly, the contractor should be paid to have to put the drywall back up. Look, it was done. Why did I have to take it off? Now I got to spend more money to bring in the drywaller back in. I got more materials, more labor, and it was fine. But in this instance, because it says it doesn't give rise to a duty or responsibility of the architect or the contractor says, I look to the owner to pay me. Even though the architect told me to stop, the architect told me to pull off the drywall because it wanted to do the inspection, so it was all done by the architect, because of the agency and because of this language, the contractor will say, owner, I get paid by you to reinstall that drywall. The flip side is if there was nothing, if there was something wrong and the architect was right, then the contractor has to pay for the fixing of the plumbing and has to pay for the drywall. And the owner, and when the contractor comes to the owner and says, pay me for this, the owner's going to say, no. And the contractor's going to say, well, you didn't tell me to do it, the architect did, so they should pay me. And the architect's going to say, no, I did it in good faith, and by the way, I'm acting under the agency of the owner, and you did it wrong. So you have to pay for it because it's wrong, and I'm under the owner's agency, and the owner says, if you did it wrong, you have to pay for it yourself. So that's what this is talking about here. This is an agency issue, and this is the only time, as you remember, that the architect is acting on behalf of the owner as its agent, because it uses the word authority. So inspection testing and to reject work. Okay? 47. This is language that talks about the owner reviewing shop drawings, or the architect reviewing the shop drawings, the submittal schedule, the timing. So this is all going to be in the same vein as what you guys learned in the B101. I'm not going to have you guys worry about remembering this for this exam, because other than to know that, because this was already, you already tested on this. You know, what are you supposed to do with shop drawings, and do you have to figure out the accuracy and completeness? There was an exam question, I think it was question 17, there was a true false. You already were tested on this. I just want to let you know 427 is mirrored language from the B101, so the contractor knows what hat the architect is wearing with respect to shop drawings, reviewing of things, and means and methods. Again, shall not constitute approval of safety or means and methods. So all of that's the same. Okay? 428, the architect will prepare change orders and construction directives and may order changes in the work as provided under Section 7.4. So we'll talk about 7.4 in a couple weeks. But a change order is, as I kind of gave the example for the house, I have a three-bedroom, two-bath house, and I want to change it to a three-bedroom, three-bath house. So the contractor saw the drawings for the three-bedroom, two-bath, bid the project for a three-bedroom, two-bath, but the owner comes back and creates a change to the design requirements, the parameters, and says, I'm going to change it to a three-bedroom, three-bath. So a change order is prepared. The architect's the one that prepares it. Sometimes it's just in writing. But sometimes in this instance, because you've got to design the third bath, there's drawings as well. So that's what a change order is. We'll talk a little bit more in detail in 2 weeks about what it is. Constructive change directive is something that happens in the field, more on the fly, and it's when you don't have all the information. Maybe you don't have price, maybe you don't have schedule, but you still have to have the work performed. So it will ultimately become a change order, but it's a change directive while you're constructing to keep the project moving. Or a minor changes to the work, you know, let's use this paint versus that paint, but something minor that happens. So again, so the architect will be the one preparing all of these documentation and data for the project. It's not the owner, it's not the contractor, it's the architect. 429, the architect conducts inspections to determine the dates of substantial completion and the dates of final completion. And it's talking about pursuant to Article Section 9.8 and 9.10 for final payment. Let's just say, again, we'll get into substantial completion more in detail in 2 weeks, but let me explain what substantial completion is briefly here. And I may have talked about this in earlier lectures, but it's relevant for this part here. So if I'm building this toy factory, the project is substantially complete when the building is fit for its intended use and purposes, meaning I can start making toys. Maybe there's some touch-up paint. Maybe they haven't finished pouring the driveway. Maybe there's some stuff that they don't have that I don't need to operate my building. If it's a house, you can move in. But maybe they got to come in and put some cover plates on the for the electrical outlets or hang a light in some room or whatever. So substantial completion is important because it's when the contractor basically turns the keys over to you and says, here's your building, you can use it. And why that's also relevant is when a project is substantially complete, there's kind of like this bright line that the warranty kicks in. So if you have a one-year warranty, it starts from substantial completion and goes from 1 year from that. The owner, and this is talked about in the B101 as well, but the owner looks to the architect to conduct the inspections to determine the specific date of substantial completion. So the architect walks around the site and says, oh yes, you can use this building for what it's for. And the remaining stuff that's left over is just punch list. So what this is doing in 429, just like what was in the B101, this is telling the contractor, it's the architect that says when it's substantially complete, not you, not the owner. The architect is going to walk around and issue the certificate of substantial completion, and then they're also one that's going to be doing final completion. So, again, this is a headline to the contractor. This is what is related to when your warranty starts. It's when the architect tells your warranty starts, and when you get final completion, the final payment. 4210. The architect will provide one or more project representatives insisting in carrying out the architect's responsibilities. So there may be more people that are used by the architect for the project, to kind of, you know, the project rep, you're going to say. 4211, architect will interpret and decide matters concerning performance under requirements of the contract documents on written request of either owner or contractor. Owner's response to such requests will be made in writing. This is partly talking about the RFI process. If there's requirements in the contract documents that there's a question by one or the other, the architect can respond to that in writing. It also has something a little bit to do with the initial decision maker, and that's partly 4212, where it says interpretive decisions of the architect will be consistent with the intent of and reasonably inferable from contract documents will be in writing in form of drawings. So both 4211 and 4212 kind of inform the contractor of the role the architect's going to take in interpreting the drawings and answering questions about the drawings and making sure that the project is properly built in accordance with the contract documents. And then it says in the last part of 412, the architect will not show partiality to either and will not be liable for results of interpretations or decisions rendered in good faith. So as long as I'm acting kind of the white hat here, and I'm not on one side or the other, then I can't be liable for my interpretation. Maybe I say that the claim should go toward the owner and the contractor should pay for it, because the drawings were fine and you should have reasonably interpreted what was in the drawings to build those giant tree pots at Navy Pier. And then if litigation ensues later on, it says the architect shall not be liable if they were acting in good faith. You know, were you really correct that your drawings had enough? You know, were you really wearing the white hat here? You weren't showing the partiality to either side. So that's 4212. And the last part of the owner-architect obligations are 4213. The architect's decisions on matters relating to aesthetic effect will be final and consistent with the intent of the express contract document. So they're the ones that say, this is what it's supposed to look like. So in this instance, they kind of are the final, they're the last decision. If it's supposed to be this color and it's not this color, the architect has that final decision. And it's not an agency issue here. It's contractor, you built it and it doesn't look right. And so you have to fix it. So they're not necessarily talking on behalf of the owner here specifically, because in that instance, what they're saying isn't binding on the owner because they get to say what the thing is supposed to look like, the color, the shape, the layout, whatever it is. And they're the final decision maker on that. And then 4214 specifically does reference requests for information. Architect will review and respond to RFIs about the contract documents. They have to do it promptly. And if necessary, they will prepare additional supplemental drawings and specs. So that's just to keep the flow of information. Your drawings weren't as clear. I have a question about it. Okay, here's my answer in writing. Here's my answer in pictorial with graphics, whatever you might need. Here's what it comes back to. Now go ahead and build what I designed. Okay? Any questions on the owner-architect obligations? We'll get to the last part of subcontractors in plenty of time. Just as a general, so when I want to kind of go back and talk about how this will sit in the exam, and I will go over this a lot more. We'll make sure we have enough time for a review session for the final exam in the last class session, and kind of I'll remind you about what's important in the A201. There will be a chunk of questions from Article 3. There will be a few questions from Article 4, but it's not going to be in the sense of what's the architect's obligation on the project, because that's kind of what was in the B101. But it may be along the lines of what does the contractor understand, and how would, if there may be a scenario where there's communication between the architect and the contractor, and you have to kind of stand in the shoes of the contractor and say, should I have listened to it, or what was going on here, the responsibilities, based on what the contractor should understand from Article 4. So that's why it's important to kind of go through that, even though it's, like I said, lots of it is mirror image from your B101. Okay? All right. Subcontractors, we'll kind of go through that. Really, there's not much left in this, but we'll talk about what it is. So the subcontractor here, who has a direct contract with the contractor. Now, if you see them, that's 511. 512, they talk about a sub-subcontractor. So like owner, triangle, contractor, umbrella, electrician. So the electrician that has the direct contract with the contractor is a subcontractor with a capital S. But the electrician has to buy wire and has to buy crimpers and has to buy conduit and all this other stuff. So that subcontractor is going to purchase all those materials from a supplier. And maybe the subcontractor, maybe under the electrical contractor is low voltage lighting. Maybe the subcontractor electrician also brings in a low voltage lighting electrician under theirs. Those are considered sub-subcontractors for the terms of this document, this agreement. In other agreements, just, and this is just a heads up, I wanted to, why I made this distinction right now. In other agreements, the term subcontractor with a capital S means of any tier, so that throughout the course of the document, the term subcontractor can be that low voltage supplier, can be the, or electrician, can be the conduit material supplier. It's anybody in that chain, and they only use the word subcontractor. So it just depends on what form you're using. Remember, for the AIA, they differentiate subcontractor and sub-subcontractor in its tiers, tier 1, tier 2, and below. Okay? The other thing is, the term subcontractor does not include a separate contractor, as capitalized here. The separate contractor is the entity, which is in Article 6, is the entity that the owner contracts with to build the kitchen. So separate contractor, capital S, capital C, is in direct contract with the owner and has no contracts with the contractor, subcontractor, or sub-subs. This is a separate and different entity that the owner controls. Okay? Those are your definitions. Next, 5.2, award of subcontracts and other contracts for portions of the work. So as stated, the contract is soon as practical after award of the contract. So once we sign the agreement, the contractor shall notify the owner, the architect, or the persons or entities proposed for each principal performance of the work, including those who have furnished materials or equipment fabricated to a specialty design. So here's what happens in the real world. You go out for bid for that $1 million house, and the owner says to the architect, I want at least 5 bids. So the architect reaches out to a bunch of home builders, and they submit their pricing to build the house. And one guy comes in at 1.2, and one woman comes in at 990, and somebody comes in at 1.4, and somebody comes in at 875, or whatever the numbers are. Okay? That contractor, to get the bid pricing, will have reached out to its various subcontractors to get and show them the drawings. So they go to the electrician, how much it will cost you to do the electrical for this house? How much it will cost you to do the plumbing for this house? So the contractor takes all the data from its various trades and subcontractors and compiles it and creates the bid. But until the contractor wins the bid, until it's awarded the contract and it's been signed, the contractor will not enter into any agreements or subcontracts with any of these trades. They just have them holding in a holding pin. Say, hey, if I get the house, now we're going to enter into a contract with you, electrician, and you, plumber, or whatever, everybody else. And so, because if they did it before and they didn't win the award, well, then they'd be in trouble. They have a contract for work that they aren't going to perform. So, what this says is, as soon as practical after the award, the contractor has to tell the owner, who's going to be doing the work? Now that I won the award, I'm going to be using Sarah's electrician and Bob's plumbing and Tom's carpentry and Tammy's drywall, whatever it is. So they have to tell the owner about this. And the reason why is because the architect, and maybe the owner, if they're sophisticated enough, may object. They may not like Bob's plumbing. They may say, you know what, I've heard bad things about Bob. You need to get somebody else. And so 5.2.1 is, again, to keep communication going between the parties. I see you're going to build my house. I think you're a good contractor. You're a good, reputable contractor. But maybe some of your trades I'm not too keen on. So let's talk about it. Or maybe they're all fine. And so if they don't object within 14 days, that's no objection and they go forward. So this allows the parties to make sure we get the right players to the game to make the project run. Okay? 5.2.2, the contractor shall not contract with someone to whom the owner or the architect has made reasonable and timely objection. So if they say, I don't like Bob's plumbing, the contractor, you know, here's what could happen. So Bob's Plumbing did the plumbing work for $150,000 in this million-dollar house. And Bob's, let's call it $100,000. And the next closest bidder from that is $175,000. There's this huge delta between Bob and everybody else. Well, if the owner says you can't use Bob, the contractor can't use Bob, and they have to go to the next one. And if the next one's $175,000, well, the price has just gone up by $75,000. But the contractor signed the contract for $1 million. And if it's set at $1 million, they don't get $1,075,000. They just get $1 million. Because they brought Bob to the table, but Bob was not proper, wasn't good. And it has to be a good objection. It has to be reasonable and everything else. But they can't contract with them. And that's what 522 says. And 523 says, if the owner has made a reasonable objection, the contractor should propose another. So maybe they bring somebody else. And if the proposed but rejected subcontractor is reasonably capable of performing the work, the contract time and some shall be increased or decreased by the difference. So let's go back to this example here. Let's say the owner says, I don't like Bob. Well, that's going to be the $75,000 increase to the price. If it's a reasonable objection, the contractor has to eat the $75,000. But if the contractor can come back and say, look, here's all the examples of why Bob does good work and Bob should be able to do the work, and the owner still says, nope, can't use Bob, if that's the instance and it's shown that Bob is reasonable and can perform the work, then the contractor does get the increase of the $75,000 because the owner is not necessarily being reasonable themselves. So this is a push-pull provision. The owner has an obligation to show that it's reasonable. The contractor can counter it, depending on where that falls out, is who ends up paying for this additional delta, the $75,000 that we're talking about. Okay? And then, however, no increase in the contract sum or time shall be allowed for such changes unless the contractor has acted promptly and responsibly in submitting names as required. Well, maybe the contractor, going back to 521, maybe they didn't give the list of the subs quickly enough. And maybe what happens is it's not that Bob is so much cheaper. It's just that when the contractor goes out, because it took a long time to give Bob the name to the owner, when the contractor then goes out to try to get somebody else to rebid, the prices have gone up. The cost of copper has gone up. The availability of workforce in the area has decreased, so then prices have gone up. So if the contractor's not timely here and not responsive in giving the names required, again, that's on the contractor's responsibility. They have to pay for it. So this is a timing thing and a reasonableness thing. This is kind of, in the world of litigation, there's a lot of gray zone in this provision 523 as to who acted the right way and who was responsible. You hope you don't get into this, but I have had projects where owners have rejected subs, and as a result of that, the price has gone up, and we've had to go through and work through 523 as to who really pays for the additional costs or the additional schedule. Okay, 5.3. Subcontract relations. So, contractors shall require each subcontractor to be bound to the contractor by the terms of the contract documents. Remember, the contract documents are what's between owner and contractor. And so what this says is it's a flow down. So if you think about, again, back to the triangle, so the owner and the contractor, and they have the solid line. And then you have the contractor with its umbrella, with all the solid lines of their trades underneath that. Well, that umbrella includes the obligations the contractor owes upstream. So if the contractor owes to the owner that they have to finish things timely, or they have to finish things correctly, or they have to do something with respect to licenses or whatever, every obligation that the contractor owes the owner, the subcontractor owes the contractor. This is what's called a flow-down provision. So it flows down, everything by the terms and conditions of the contract document flows down to the subcontractor, and to assume toward the contractor all obligations, responsibilities, including the responsibilities for safety of subcontractors' works, that the contractor, by these contractors, assumes toward the owner and the architect. So if I owe a duty upstream to the owner, then you owe that duty upstream to me, subcontractor. So that's this flow-down provision, and it flows up the same way. And this is to keep consistency in a project. Basically, it's saying, in the really simplest terms, we're all playing by the same rules of Monopoly. So when we go ahead and play the game, somebody's not making it up on their own. And the owner can rely on the contractor to get the work done for the rules of Monopoly, because the owner knows the contractor is playing the same rules of Monopoly with the subcontractor. Does that make sense? Okay. 5.3 just says that if we can get a copy of the proposed subcontract agreement, give that to the owner. And what this is really good, because I want to see is the owner, if I represent the owner, if the owner's there, I want to see the terms of the agreement between contractor and subcontractor. I want to see language in there that says, hey, what I owe the owner, you owe to me. I want to see the payment structure. I want to see how the thing's working. So that's what 5.3 says. 5.4, this is what's called contingent assignments of subcontracts. So this is something that you hope you don't ever have to exercise, but it's important to have in the agreement between you, owner, and contractor. So this talks about each subcontract agreement is assigned by the contractor to the owner. This is at the very beginning, provided that the assignment is only affected after termination of the contract by the owner for cause. So what this basically says is, let's say we're working on a project and the contractor has done just a terrible job in managing time and schedule and everything else. So we're in a $1 million house. It's going to take 12 months to build and we're 3 months in and the project is already looking to be $200,000 over budget. They've blown the schedule. It's now looking it's going to be 16 months instead of 12 months. There's all these problems with them trying to get additional costs. We have to pay for it. It's a breach, et cetera, et cetera. There's big fights. And so the owner has to terminate the contractor for cause for breach of the contract. However, the owner really likes the electrician and the plumber and the finished carpenter that was under the contract with the contractor. And we like the pricing that has been quoted by the electrician, by the plumber, and the finished carpenter. So when there's a termination by cause of the main contract with the general contractor, this provision 5.4.1 says that subcontract with the electrician, the plumber, and the finished carpenter is assigned to the owner. If you remember, we talked about assignment before. So now I, as the owner, hold that contract, that subcontract, and the promises in that one, including the pricing. So I can bring that subcontractor under my new umbrella, and maybe I get a new contractor myself, or maybe I run the project myself. But I can bring those trades in that I like, and I can keep them because of the contingent assignment. It's an assignment that's contingent on a termination for cause. Not for convenience, just for cause. So this is important, termination for cause. And it's only those subcontracts I accept as the owner. I don't want your rough carpenter. He's terrible. That's why you guys are behind. I don't want your concrete person. They're awful. I just want your plumber, your electrician, and your finished carpenter. So the owner has control over here. If there's a breach by the contractor, if there's a termination for cause, the owner can pick up whatever subs it wants. Then that, so that's in 5.1.1. 5.4.1.1. 5.4.1.2 says if you accept assignments of the subcontract agreement, well then now you're standing in the shoes of the contractor. So whatever the contractor owed the sub, you own the sub. Which makes sense because you now hold that contract in your hand. You're the party of it. And then finally, last slide here. If the work has been suspended for more than 30 days, The subcontractor's compensation can be equitably adjusted for increases in costs resulting from suspension. And that's just with anything. The contractor has that obligation. We'll talk about that later. If there's a suspension or delay, contractor gets, and it costs more money for the sub just to sit around, the sub can get those dollars, and the owner will know about that. And then finally, upon assignment, and that can happen when you're doing a termination for cause, getting the contractor out or bringing the sub in. So let's say the finished carpenter was going to do its millwork for the project for $95,000. And then you terminate the contractor and you bring the millworker in and some of these other trades. And it turns out that in the period while you're doing all the legal stuff of switching contracts over and everything else, the project has been delayed. If the millworker comes back and says, well, now the contract's 110, this provision 542, if it's been suspended more than 30 days, shall allow the millworker to get that additional cost or time that they sat around or what have you. So that's 542. And then finally, upon assignment to the owner under this section, the owner may then further assign the subcontractor to a successor contractor or other entity. So what this says is, to terminate my first general contractor because they're a deadbeat, they're doing terrible work, I take assignment of those subcontracts I like. But I'm just a person. I'm not a contractor. I don't know what the heck I'm doing. And I go out and I hire a new general contractor. And I said to the general contractor, I got these three trades. They're going to come work with you, and here's their subcontract. The general contractor says, okay, but I need that. So then the owner assigns this first assigned subcontract to the new general contractor. But it doesn't get out of the legal responsibility for the successor contractor's obligation. So the owner still has some liability even though they're assigning it. The owner still has legally responsible for the successor's contracts under the successor contractor's obligations under the subcontract. Okay? Any questions on subcontracts? All right, good. So we will start in 2 weeks on Article 6 and get through, I know it's two-thirds of the agreement, but we will get through all of that without a problem. One last thing on the exam, and then one last thing about papers. So expect for Article 2, 3, and 4, there'll be a lot more from 3 through 4 and 5. There'll be a lot more questions on 3 than the other sections that we've gone over, but you will have at least one question on subcontracts. You'll at least have at least one question on the architect. There may be more on both of those. So there'll be something from each one of these articles, at least one of these sections on the agreement. And then finally, like I said, anybody that's reached out to me, I know I owe a couple people responses on papers. Feel free if you want to, anybody else wants to reach out, and we can work through to get us topics so you can put things together. All right? Thanks, guys. Have a nice weekend.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. Bye. You too. Bye.